All right, this meeting will come to order, and we're going to go right to our items of business this morning. And Representative Cornish, I believe yours is the first bill. Representative Dimmer?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I would move House File 22.
We
don't have a quorum.
We just move it before the committee.
Well, then, good morning, Madam Chair.
Good morning. That's right, we're missing one person for a quorum. Go ahead, Representative Cornish.
Madam Chair and members, House File 2246 is a fund transfer bill for the Lake Crystal Walker Memorial School District within my area, 24B. I'm going to give just a bare-bones explanation and no sense for me rambling on when I have an expert at my side. So the Lake Crystal Walker Memorial School District has found itself in a little bit of a pickle here with some statutory operating debt and some other problems, and would like your help in getting out of it with the attendance to this bill 2246, which allows them to more freely use some of their money with a fund transfer. And I would like to introduce Superintendent Les Norman from Lake Crystal Walker Memorial, who could give you a better explanation of the bill and its ramifications. Thank you.
All right, sir. Please introduce yourself for the record and give us your explanation.
Madam Chair, representatives, my name is Les Norman. I'm the Superintendent of Schools for the Lake Crystal Walker Memorial School District. The proposal that we have before you this morning, it was primarily to do some fund transfers. We've got a fund transfer for disabled access that we'd like to have transferred to the general fund balance. And we'd also have a fund transfer from the operating capital from the sale of school district properties that we would also like to request having that being transferred to the school district's general fund balance. Well, good morning to you all. We've got some of the background information that you will need to know is that our school district is a sits between Mankato and New Ulm, just south of the Minnesota River. We're a school district of 212 square miles, just under 800 students.
Okay.
And the school district has been trying to develop a new buildings. We've had the buildings that we've had in the district. First of all, we're a school district that has had three consolidations. At one time, we had five schools operating in our school district. We are now at two schools. Both schools, an elementary school and a high school, are located in the city of Lake Crystal. Beginning in 1994, the school district has tried to develop bond issues, and between 1994 and 2000, there were six failed bond referendums in our school district. In September of 2004, we were able to pass a bond referendum for a new secondary school. And with that passed, we no longer needed the high school, which is a high school that was built in 1926, added on to in 1953. The reason for the disabled access, in 1996, the school district sought additional funds to put in an elevator at the high school, as well at the 1953 building, and they were able to use dollars from disabled access. And at this point, with the development of a new high school, we no longer will need those particular dollars for the for any type of disabled access. The elementary school that we have, that was built in 1972, is fully accessible, and now with the new high school coming on board, we know that that will have all the handicapped accessibility that is possibly needed. So the funds that we have that are in excess, just in excess of $132,000, we'd like to have transferred from our the reserve fund for disabled access to be able to have that moved to the general fund balance. The second request that we have deals with the money that's reserved in Operation Capital. Because we have developed a new high school, We have land, primarily land that was developed in the early 20s for football fields, softball fields, tennis courts, and so on, which are located in the downtown area of the city of Lake Crystal. We will no longer need those properties, and we're looking at selling those properties because we now have a new school that will be built on 49 acres of land that is just west of the city of Lake Crystal. So the school board has determined that they don't no longer need these properties, and what they would like to do is to have the ability to move dollars from the sale of these properties, which originally will go into the operating capital fund, and we'd like to be able to have the opportunity to move that into the general fund balance.
Superintendent Norman, you have no dollar amount. Do you have any idea what you are going to get for the land?
Well, for the land, at minimum, we would have at least $100,000 that we believe that we would make for that. That would be the minimum. Of course, realtors would like to see it lower than that, of course, when they're trying to sell, but we believe that we're very reasonable at that particular cost, because this land can be used for other types of development in the city of Lake Crystal.
So you would expect $100,000 or more, and
that's
you want
correct.
The ability to transfer all of it?
That's correct, yes.
All right, Representative Demmer.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. Actually, I have two questions, if that's okay. One of them, Lake Crystal Walk Memorial is in a statutory operating debt, I understand.
That's correct.
These transfers would be one-time funds, one-time injections of money. What's the plan, is Superintendent Norman, is that right?
That's correct.
What's the plan going forward? You get this one-time money to spend on operating expenses. What's the plan for next year and going forward to replace these funds, and how would you replace these funds in subsequent years?
Certainly, good question. Last week we met with Commissioner Segrin as well as with Tom Melcher, because what we were doing at that time was to review our statutory operating debt plan with them. We recognize that this is one-time transfers. However, if you're familiar with the dollars that are set aside for the reserve funds, they would be moved only to the to reduce the one-time transfer for reducing the statutory operating debt balance that we have. And we recognize that it's only a one-time transfer. We are in the process of making reductions of well over $500,000 for this year.
For this year, sir?
For this year, yes. And we know that if we are not able to utilize these dollars if we're not going to be able to receive these dollars, then more additional cuts that we will have to make as far as positions and programs are concerned.
Representative Gemmer.
Okay, Madam Chair, thank you. Superintendent Norman, we also have, you have an organization in the area, Citizens for Quality Education Committee.
That's correct.
I assume it's a consortium of parents, citizens who have kids in your school. They're opposed to you doing these things. Can you speak to that a bit? I'm sure you're familiar and had a conversation with them.
Certainly.
Could you speak to that issue of the citizens and being opposed to you doing this sort of thing and kind of what's happening there?
Those individuals are here this morning and perhaps will be wanting to testify on their behalf also. From our perspective, we have developed bond issues, as I've mentioned, since 1994. We're a multiply consolidated district. As a result of closing buildings and so on, these individuals are trying to seek tax relief of some sort at any way. So what happens is that when the school district brings forward a bond referendum, they typically have been defeated by this particular group. And their positions are primarily tax-based. They call themselves the Citizen for Quality Education. And they generally spend a great deal of time in our offices and in our board meetings monitoring what we're doing as far as the schools are concerned. This particular committee has done something that I feel is a new change in public education. And I entered the classroom in 1967. I've certainly spent quite a bit of time in other schools. And this is the first time that I have encountered a group that would hire individuals from, hire an individual whose sole purpose it is to come in and help a citizen group defeat a school bond referendum. So not only do we have to face the public at large as we normally do, but now we have professional organized opposition. And so it becomes much more daunting in public education to deal with the issues of trying to provide good education, good sound buildings, et cetera, et cetera.
Okay, thank you.
Representative Biskins, Representative Demmer, why don't you go ahead and move the bill? We have a...
Thank you, Madam Chair. I would then move House File 2246 to be laid over for possible inclusion in the K-12 Omnibus Bill.
Representative Biskins.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Madam Chair, as Superintendent, I'll get to an issue that this group probably has nothing to do with, and that deals with enrollment projections. What's your opinion of enrollment?
Representative, Madam Chair, Representative, would you repeat that, please?
What's your current enrollment?
Our current enrollment is just under 800 students.
Madam Chair?
Representative Biskins.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Superintendent, could you be a little more precise? I see that your projection in your worksheet was for 798. Is that your enrollment, or is it less than that?
That is our enrollment.
Okay. Yes. Madam Chair?
Representative Biskins.
Right. Well, Madam Chair, I guess I'll save this for the next testifiers, and thank you.
All right. Did you have anyone else who was going to testify? If not, we'll have the other people come up.
No, Madam Chair, as far as I know.
All right. Then we had the group from Citizens for Quality Education, a gentleman named Joel Brood. Is that correct, or is it Broody? Broody. Sorry about that. You know I'd guess wrong. We have your written comments here, so if you would like to just emphasize certain points or,
I sure will. In fact, that was the purpose. We have that information in front of you today. Madam Chair and members of the Education Finance Committee, my name is Joel Broody. I'm the chairman of the Citizens for Quality Education Committee. We are a political group, and we stand here today opposed to these fund transfers. Despite all the difficulties with SOD that the district has had, somehow they still got a bond referendum passed for a new high school. And some of these monies, I'll get right down to the points here, the disabled access funds represent monies that have already been taxed to the residents. And if they were going to be used anywhere, they should be used on the new construction, not be returned to try to provide a temporary fix to the SOD problem. And the same scenario applies to the sale of the land. These proceeds should be used for new construction if that's going to take place, rather than double taxing the taxpayers again. Both of the monies, if applied to the current general fund, only provide just a short-term fix to the SOD. It does nothing to correct the long-term finances, which is a long-term cuts that are necessary to get the balanced budget again. But we are very active, as Superintendent Norman told you. We are not in favor of the new high school. In fact, based on the information that was provided to the Department of Education, we believe the voters are not given the true facts. And we oppose the referendum, and we also question the wisdom of proceeding with that bond referendum as well and the building of that new building. With that in mind, I'd be happy to answer any questions. That's the main points that we're going to get across today.
Other questions? Representative Clemson.
Thank you. We received an email, and I'm not sure if it was from your group or someone surrounding your group, that was critical of the Minnesota Department of Education's review and comment for the high school project. And I wondered if you know about that and if you could speak to that at all.
Yes, in fact.
Mr. Broody.
Pardon?
Mr. Broody.
Yes.
I just have to identify you for the record, so.
Okay.
Go ahead.
Madam Chair. The question again about the Minnesota Department of Education. We are critical for a couple reasons. First of all, we don't feel that they were given the right information about the current financial status of Lake Crystal Walk Memorial School District. And secondly, any school that's in SOD, we believe, shouldn't be given permission to proceed with the bond referendum anyway. So those are the two points I'd make on that mail.
Representative Clancy.
Thank you. Mr. Broody, it's come to my attention recently that the review and comments isn't necessarily a permission or an authorization, but more of just a comment on what could happen. I was wondering if your group or the citizens in your community were aware of that.
Yes, we were.
But
we
Mr. Still Broody.
Felt, we still felt that they were a little lax in their digging into the actual situation. In fact, the SOD figure of $312,000 that came out of the audit at the end of June of 2004 was way off the numbers that were actually given in the review of comment, and that should have been much more visible as far as the financial condition. I realize that they are not giving endorsements. However, I think that they should have been discouraging that bond referendum from proceeding.
The bond referendum has already passed, is that correct?
Bond referendum passed in September. Madam Chair, yes. Construction has not begun though yet, however.
And when is that scheduled to begin?
Well, we're not sure. I think there's some questions all about the dates and how quickly that can begin, but it has not started yet.
All right. Representative Biskins.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Broody is here. Legal residence within the White Crystal Welcome Memorial School District.
Yes, it is. In fact, the members of our
Mr.
committee...
Mr. Broody.
I'm sorry, Madam Chair. I keep interrupting you there. The members of our committee are made up of residents and parents within the school district of Lake Crystal, Garden City, Rapidan, and Vernon Center.
Madam Chair.
Representative Biskins.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Madam Chair, Mr. Broody, are you hired? Are you paid for your activities in connection with the Citizens for Quality Education?
Mr. Broody.
No, in fact, we're just a volunteer group that is very concerned about educational issues within our district and actually statewide for that matter, too. So,
Madam Chair.
Representative Biskins.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Broody, to get to the issue I was going to, that I started with the superintendent, I point blank asked superintendent on record what his enrollment was, and he said that it is 798. I have information from your organization that says the enrollment is 760. Can you help me understand the discrepancy here?
Mr. Broody.
The last information we had was that the student enrollment stood at 760. I think that figure is high. But to tell you today exactly where those numbers are coming from, I can't do that. I don't know what they've presented or what they have that provides them with those figures.
All right. Representative Erickson, I think this will probably be the last question.
Thank you, Chair Sikora. Mr. Broody, what is your plan and your organization's plan for helping the school district get out of statutory operating debt?
Well, our plan is cuts. It's inevitable that they're going to have to be long-term cuts made to make this balanced budget and continue on. But our district faces, like every district, the loss of enrollment. And we've had a very steep loss of enrollment because while we closed school buildings, we also provided them an opportunity or an option for people to open enroll because part of our district around the Rapidan area and Vernon Center, those areas are closer to Maple River and Mankato, so it was very easy for them to make a decision to go there instead.
Madam Chair. Representative Erickson.
Mr. Broody, in 2002, an operating levy was renewed, and now another would have to be renewed, according to your handout, in 2006. With the people of the district knowing the financial dilemma, what, in your estimation, is the reason for passage of these operating levies?
Mr. Broody.
Well, it goes back to finances for school districts. While we studied, for example, when the bond referendum was coming up for vote in September, other districts that have built new high schools, inevitably their operating costs were higher. Inevitably they were still giving teacher salary increases that were way beyond the rate of inflation or the amounts provided by the state. And so they continually get themselves in trouble. There's not a lot of accountability, it seems to me, in some of those areas that are causing these problems. Now, we don't know what's going to happen with this additional levy now coming up in September. Mm-hmm. Our committee has not taken a stand yet at this point, but even if that passes, they're probably still looking at having to come back with another operating levy sometime again in a few years, I'm sure, because of declining enrollment and operating expenses over that school.
So one last question, Madam Chair.
Representative Erickson.
Thank you, Chair Sikora. And Mr. Broody, Does your group have a specific plan to help the district? Have you laid out a framework and submitted it to the school board and the superintendent? Or are these just ideas that you're discussing?
Okay.
Very quickly, please.
We have not given a formal plan to the school board. However, we have made it quite clear that we were opposed to the bond referendum and that we felt that at this time, at this point, with the declining enrollment, that it was going to be very difficult to keep the new high school going and operating with the kind of declines in enrollment that we'd have. So, no, we have not done a formal, but I'm sure they're well aware of our positions on things.
All right, Representative Dorn also had a quick question.
I hope, Madam Chair, it's quick, and thank you. And it seems to me a piece that it would be good for us to hear is we're talking about projections in enrollment and declining enrollment, and I'm just wondering if people have, I'm sure, a point of view, what they could tell us in terms of the interplay of the school facilities with the decision to open enroll and what people are thinking will happen in terms of the school enrollment with new buildings in terms of their projections at the impact of the facilities on people's decision to open and roll, and I realize that's asking everybody to come up with numbers based on guesses, but it would seem to me that you know, that has to be a part of what we're hearing and, you know, a part of what would fit for the future of the district. I just wonder how people can, but if I can get a little education on what people think, and I don't know if the superintendent would have a response to that too, but
I really think the superintendent, we should have a second from the superintendent just to tell us what is your plan to get out of SOD. I assume the board and the superintendent have a plan by now, rather than asking Mr. Broody what the plan is to get out of SOD. So would that be okay if we bring the superintendent up?
Yeah, and how enrollment in the
all
future.
Right.
What does that new building do to the enrollment projections?
Okay, so
never mind. I'd like to hear that.
All right.
Mr.
Broody, thank you very much for your time. And Mr. Norman, superintendent, would you please come up and tell us what your plan is?
Yep.
So that we would know, because we have to move on here, and I just think it's important that we know that before we have to deliberate on how to handle this. So as quickly as possible, what is your plan to get out of SOD? You've had, I think you've been in it about 3 years now, 4 years?
Madam Chair, the school district has been in statutory operating debt for the last 3 years. The last plan included a number of options for it. Among them was to receive an additional 2% per year from state funding. And that's when we initially did the plan 3 years ago. And, of course, you know what has happened since that time. It's been very difficult for us to come up with a plan simply because of state funding. We've had to look at other options, those options primarily being reductions. Our plan includes, for this year, we started out with a plan including no increase in state funding. However, I can smile at this point after talking with Commissioner Segrin as well as Tom Melcher that indeed is not true. It looks as if we're going to be receiving additional funding.
What's in our bill at the present time, sir, is 2.5% each year.
And at this point, we're planning on 2%, just to make sure, because we want to make sure that we can have some work there. We're also looking at reductions in operational expenses of more than $500,000. A lot of those are staff reductions. We're also looking at passing a bond referendum. That is a key part of our plan. However, that will not take place till we won't receive funding for that until the 2006-2007 school year. And so we're wanting to make sure that we have that piece put in place. In addition to that, we've also have contacted Commissioner Segrin as well as Tom Mouser to see if they would support us with regard to the proposals that we brought forward to you today, because that certainly is part of the plan. If these do not come to pass, it means for us that we will have to make additional reductions in programs and positions in order to achieve where we want to be. Our objective in meeting with Commissioner Segrin as well as Tom Melcher was to see if we could get an additional year in our plan so that we wouldn't have to make as much reductions as we possibly could. Right now, we are finding that they're telling us to, just as what has been established in in statute is that we need to be out in 1 year. So that's what they have notified us at this particular point.
I believe, considering the fact that you have already been in SOD for 3 years, that expecting you to get out of it now, it's timely. But so I appreciate your comments, and we will lay this over like we do all of these, and then make a decision as to whether or not they will be included in the final bill. And I will, Manny, I will talk to Commissioner Segrin to find out, you know, what their plan was for you, or what you've been working on together.
Madam Chair, I certainly appreciate that. Thank you.
Okay, thank you very much.
Thank you, Madam Chair, member.
Thank you, Representative Cornish, Representative Junkie. I will move House File. Oh, and we forgot the enrollment question. What is the enrollment, Superintendent? What was your enrollment?
The enrollment that Mr. Broody was talking about is K-6. We also have preschool programs which are counted in that, our early childhood family programs. Yeah. So the number that I gave you deals primarily with adding those numbers on top of that.
Oh. All right. Representative Junkie, and do you have people here?
Madam Chair, I have one witness.
All right. I will move Representative Junkie's bill, which is House File 2272, before the Committee for Possible Inclusion in the Omnibus Bill. Representative Junkie.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you for the opportunity to quickly testify before your committee. House File 2272 is one of many fund transfer bills that this body is seeing introduced this year, and certainly I think it is indicative of what's going on. Particularly, I know obviously in rural Minnesota there seems to be almost an epidemic of deferred maintenance money, Madam Chair, and this bill is addressing one of those problems also. This is for the Atwater Cosmos Grove City School. I have the Atwater side. You see the other author is Representative Erdahl. He lives in Grove City, and actually this roof is down in Cosmos that my superintendent will talk about. Again, members, I know you're going to be in discussions on how to address all these concerns on deferred maintenance, and certainly I would rather that the legislature address this for all schools rather than one individual at a time as we come through. But barring that and keeping our options open, we thought it was prudent to at least hear from these districts and what their problems are, and perhaps help craft a solution this year for them. So with that, Madam Chair, I turn it over briefly to Pam Killingstead, the superintendent of the ACGC School District.
Ms. Killingstead, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair, representatives. As introduced, I am Pam Killingstead, the superintendent for ACGC Public School. We are a school district of approximately 350 miles. We're very long and fairly narrow, and have the same problems other districts have, in the fact that we are losing enrollment. Some of it is due to open enrollment because we are bordered by five very good school districts, and it's distance and convenience for parents is one of those things that causes open enrollment. The other factor is that most of our farm families are having fewer children. We were kind of on the leading edge of the reductions in students and are now stabilizing. We have 1 year left of big class sizes, and then we will be three sections per class in all of our K through 12. We're currently at about 850 students, and I'm guessing that we will even out at about 835, 840. So we have seen over the past few years a reduction in dollars that we can use in our operating capital, since the operating capital dollars are tied to our student numbers. Unfortunately, the cost of doing business hasn't changed over those years. So what we're asking is that we are be allowed to take the dollars in our debt redemption fund that are over and above the $900,000 that we pay in bond redemption and move them to our capital fund in order to help us to pay for a new roof at our South Elementary School.
All right, any questions? All right, hearing no, Representative.
Madam Chair, Mr. Strom, is this fund transfer from the debt redemption fund in the same category as the disabled accessibility account?
Madam Chair,
Mr. Strom.
That's right. This is one the committee would have to carry a levy consequently.
Thank you.
All right. Hearing no other questions, thank you very much, and thank you for making the trip up here.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members.
And this will be laid over for consideration. Moving on to Representative Posh. This is for Posh. Representative Posh, did you have anybody with you?
Madam Chair, I do not. I'm Superintendent Burlingame, had to attend a funeral this morning.
Oh, all right. Go ahead. I did have a name down here, but that's fine. Why don't you go ahead and explain your bill, Representative? I will move House File 2138 before the committee to be considered for possible inclusion.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And again, Superintendent Burlingame apologizes that he cannot attend today's hearing. This bill is pretty much exactly what Representative Junkie just went over. This is a transfer from the debt redemption fund to the reserved operating capital account to the tune of $112,500. Just some background on the financial situation in the Painesville Area School District is anticipated fund balance after the month of June in the debt redemption fund will be over $333,000. So this $112,500 will still allow that debt redemption fund to have a healthy balance. The funds will be anticipated to be used for two roofing projects, one on the high school and one on the elementary, in which repairs have been neglected, and they have patches over patches. And being a commercial roofer for over 6 years, I do know the concerns that we have when we just try to put a Band-Aid on a problem, and also the increased costs that only occur when we don't fix the problem the way that it should be. To that tune, I just, since there's a need to be brief, I would just like to see if there's any questions from any of the members.
The two roofing projects, have you no money in your capital fund to do any of this?
There is some money in the capital fund. Right now, the district receives $254,000 in operating capital aid from the state, but they've identified over $2 million of roofing needs throughout the school district on the elementary, the middle school, and the high school. And these are just addressing the greatest needs that they have for roof repairs, and they do have a capital improvement plan for dealing with all the roof repairs.
Okay. Any questions? Seeing none, thank you very much, Representative.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, members.
All right. This will be laid over for possible inclusion also.
Thank you.
And Representative Cornish. The minerals. Oh, was he here? Never get too far away, Representative Cornish.
I forgot about it. I took off to my other meeting.
All right, this is, and members, I really want you to listen carefully to this. This is what was mentioned rather casually earlier in the year when we had a report on the permanent trust lands. And this is a proposal from the DNR. And I think we really need to listen carefully to it. And then, you know, probably what we will do with this, Representative Cornish, is lay it over just for the time being so that we can maybe talk a little bit more about it. But I think that we would like to hear all the important particulars on this one as we go through the bill today. So please go ahead and discuss your bill. I did move the bill. Did I? In case I didn't, maybe I didn't. I'd move 1133 before the committee for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill.
Madam Chair and members, for brevity's sake, I think I'll just introduce Mr. Bryce and let him explain the bill. I know your time is crunched here, so Mr. Bryce.
Welcome to the committee, Mr. Bryce.
Thank you.
Thank you for being here. I know you had another meeting, so I really appreciate your time this morning.
Madam Chair, my name is Bill Bryce. I'm the Director of Lands and Minerals. What I wanted to do this morning is first do a kind of a little introduction on the school trust land and the school trust fund and how it works, and then go into explaining this mineral management account. The school trust fund is a fund that derives income to the corpus of the fund from management at the DNR, and we manage the land that the state received as a grant when Minnesota became a state back in the 1860s. So the fund today has about $578 million in it, and that fund is no money can be spent from that fund except from the income. In order to increase the size of the fund, we manage the school lands, and we manage them for minerals, we manage them for real estate, and we manage them for forestry. And the part of the management that we're talking about today in the mineral management count is, of course, the minerals part. And then you have a bill later today to talk about some of the real estate management. But this is about the minerals management account. The Division of Minerals used to be a separate division and was consolidated a couple of years ago. And minerals has, for the most part, always been supported by the general fund. And the income that the division generates goes to the various accounts that was derived from. I didn't say that very well. Sorry. So what this proposal is basically an alternative to funding from the general fund. In the past, we've always, as I said, been funded by the general fund, and this is an option where it would create a minerals management account that would take 20% of all the minerals revenue and create a new account, and then minerals management would be funded from that account into the future. And it's an approach that we think is a long-term approach to making sure that the minerals income continues at a reasonable amount, and will help long-term to provide stable funding for doing the kinds of minerals things that need to be done to continue to generate the income that we generate. The way the fund works is it dedicates 20% from all of the revenue sources that we derive income from. So the school trust land is one of the sources. The university trust land is another source. The tax forfeited land is a third source. And then there's other acquired land as well. And so it basically creates a fund that takes 20% out of all of those accounts and puts it into a new fund called the mineral management account. That means that 80% of the money that we have been receiving to date will continue to go to the funds as they have in the past. So for schools, 80% of the money will continue to go in the same path that it's always gone in and go directly to the school fund.
Mr. Bryce?
Yes.
20% would be the maximum the school fund would be charged.
Yes, Madam Chair. And in fact, the other part of the fund that we have proposed in this legislation is to... And we cap the fund at 20%, but if the costs of managing minerals are less than that, then we would return the excess money back to the school and university funds. They're the two largest receivers currently, and so it would go back to that. So just now as an example, in the first year, and we should probably hand these sheets out to kind of explain this. I have two handouts here that we could show you. This current year, to manage minerals base or income, the cost is about $1,526,000. And so you will see that on the sheet. And then there's an initiative in the proposal to increase that funding by $420,000. As soon as the sheets get around, I can explain that.
Mr. Bryce, what would other lands be?
Madam Chair, Usually other lands are acquired lands, but they may be actually other lands from even other agencies. We've managed some lands for the Department of Transportation, Historical Society, and so on. But we, as a department, of course, we've acquired a lot of lands for various particular purposes, and on occasion those acquired lands also generate mineral income. And so in that case, like if it was a Game and Fish acquired, it would go back to the Game and Fish Fund, and if it was Water Rec acquired, it would go back to the Water Rec account, and so on. So that's the other.
All right. Thank you. Everybody has this now?
I think everybody has this sheet now. This is the sheet with the three block tables. At the top of the sheet, it was our original estimate when this budget was prepared for 2006, 7, 8, and 9 for income from minerals management. And you can see it's broke down by funds, school fund, university fund, tax forfeited, and other. And so just to put this all in perspective, our estimated income for 2005, the year that we're currently in, was $12.4 million. So if you put 2005 on that sheet of paper before 2006, you could write 12.4 as our estimate. So what would happen with this fund is that 20% of all of the revenue from the $15.5 million at the top of the sheet would go into a mineral management account, and you see that in the second block on the sheet, and that would be $3,112,000. From that, we're asking for an appropriation of $1,526,000 as a base appropriation to replace general fund from our for our management of the minerals, and an increased appropriation of $420,000. And then at the bottom of that block, you see that there's a year-end balance of $1,166,000. As that minerals is a very cyclical business. One year it's up, making a lot of money, and another year it's down. It's in Minnesota. It's based largely in the steel industry, and it used to be based mostly on the U.S. steel industry, but today it's based on the world steel industry. And so it's very cyclical. It'll go up and down. And so the purpose of having a fund in the middle, rather than just a direct appropriation, is so that you can balance out the low years from the high years. Then in 2007, you can see the amount of money in the fund increases to $2,008,000, and in 2008, the amount of money increases to the cap, which is in this bill also, which is $3 million. And the reason for that is we believe that that's adequate funding to cover any of the cyclical years. And so on that year, there was an excess of $1,217,000, and you see that on the chart as well. And that $1,217,000 would go back to the school and university trust funds. That would reduce the amount of the percentage of the cost that we would be charging the accounts from 20% to some lesser amount, 15, 16, 17, whatever it turns out. So by then the account should be returning money also to the thing. So in this proposal, we would always continue to return 80% of the income to the accounts as we had originally proposed. And in addition, we would return any money over the $3 million. So the question probably you have now is why would we do this? Because this has always been general fund. From the 1800s, I presume it was general fund, but I wasn't here in the 1800s. But at least from 1970, when I did come to the department, it's always been general fund. And so so I have some answers on that, and we'll see what you think of my answers.
Go ahead, Mr. Bright.
One of the reasons that you might consider this is so that the users would share in the cost of earning the income. If you look at normal financial activities, it's often a policy that the users would pay for the cost of managing the program, and then they would receive the income from the program. So that's one area. A second area is that in minerals, it would provide a more stable source of funding for the division. Minerals has in 2001, we had $5.2 million going to minerals and reclamation. And today we have $3.6 million. So there's been a 31% reduction in this program at the same time that there has been an increase in income. And if we continue to cut the program further because of shortages in the general fund, we believe we won't be doing a very good job managing minerals, and your income today will continue to drop. Will begin to drop because there's just not enough money going into the program right now to sustain that income over a long period of time. And our goal is, of course, to keep providing mineral income to the school trust fund for the next 50 years, if we can, or longer. And so we think that's a very important fact. And at this point, there are a number of things that we should be doing in the program that we currently are not doing. Things that we have done in the past, and you will see those listed on the back page of your sheet. And that's the purpose of the $420,000 increase, to get back to doing some of the things that we believe in the long term generate income to this account. And so at some point, if you'd like me to explain some of those, or if you have questions on those, I'd be happy to answer those. But that's the third thing that we should think about. Now, the last thing is that we should talk a little about is the income that the minerals program is currently generating. In 2000, and I mentioned it to you to write in fiscal year 2005 here on the chart, and the estimate was $12.4 million. Well, 2005 ended on March 31st, because the last payment that goes into the account this year is April 20th. And so at this point, that number that we estimated at 12.4 probably exceeds 20 million. And so we've done substantially better this year by 7.5 million at least over what we had originally estimated. So we would estimate probably the future years would also have some increases. The main reason for making so much more money. Okay. Yes, Madam Chair.
Well, the $20 million, is that the university and the permanent school trust lands, or is that just the permanent school trust
That's
lands?
The total revenue.
Total revenue.
Yeah, and that would include school, university, tax forfeit, and other.
All right.
And I can't give you the breakdown yet because we don't have the final payment, but we have an estimate of the ore that was mined. And
okay.
So we'll have that in a while, but we don't have that right away.
Okay.
But you could predict that it would be roughly proportional to what we estimated. And what we estimated was roughly a 40% school, 40% university, and 10% tax forfeit. So it would probably, the $20 million will be roughly in that same proportion.
Okay.
For this year anyway, we're doing very good. And I was going to mention why. The main reason for the increase, there are two of them. One is the world economy has changed as far as natural resources. You know, the price of oil is up. Well, the price of taconite and iron ore is up, too. And so our royalty rates have increased this year by about 20%. That's due to indexes that we have in the leases. And then production on our property has also increased. And that's due to world demand being up and being able to sell absolutely as much taconite as you possibly can produce. And so for those two reasons, our income this year is up. There's no sign right now that it will drop, but the minerals program is cyclical. So I think that's kind of my presentation on this minerals management account.
Okay, and I think we have several questions just on the minerals management account at this point.
Okay.
Representative Biskins.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Madam Chair, Mr. Bryce, you mentioned twice in your presentation that the minerals program is cyclical. All right. And yet, what you're asking us for is a flat rate base appropriation. All right. Why would you not ask then for a percentage appropriation so that when the cycle is down, it's not actually eating into the trust fund? All right. I mean, most money managers work off percentage, and yet you're asking for flat rate. Can you explain that?
Yes, Madam Chair, Representative, we're asking for 20%. We're not asking for a flat rate. We're asking for a 20% rate, and we think that the 20% rate will be somewhat high, and so we're capping the fund at $3 million so that a future amount of money that exceed the 20% that are over the $3 million will also be returned to the trust funds.
Okay. That didn't quite answer your question.
I think it did. Thank you. Madam Chair, I do have a comment, though. Right, on this issue, and I'll just make it very quick. Mr. Bryce talked about a user fee. People who gain the revenue should pay for the revenue, and that's a thought. However, over and over and over again in education, we hear that education itself is a state benefit, right, and that it isn't something set aside, but it's that the whole state gains from. And so, I think quite appropriately, the state has managed the trust lands through a general fund obligation because the whole general populace shares in the benefit of the healthy fund. So it is a different a different cap education, I'm always told, than most other areas of the state budget, and appropriately so. So I think it is a huge policy philosophy shift that you're asking us to consider here, and I don't mind considering things that are different and outside the box, and so I thank you for bringing this forward. I don't know where I sit on it yet, but you're out there. I like that. Thank you.
Representative Demmer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Bryce, I guess I'm looking at the proposed mineral management activity account activity box, the second one down. Couple questions, and you can deal with these in totality, or you can take them one at a time, whatever. I'm looking at expenditures of $1.5 million, it appears, in each of 06 and 07, $420,000 for enhancement, which I think in your documentation here says it's to help marketing and help stabilize and increase revenues. Mm-hmm. But then I see in 08 and 09, you're looking at decreases in revenues, and the expenditures in enhancement are being transferred up into the management area. So it appears that our expenditures and enhancements are not doing well in terms of your projected revenues. We're spending money to enhance revenues, and yet we're looking at decreased revenues in the 2 years after that, plus the marketing money going up into management. Can you speak to that and reconcile how those projections and the increased management expense and maybe even touch a little bit on what's in the management, the $1.5 million in management?
Mr. Bryce.
Madam Chair, Representatives, I'll try, and if I get part of it, then you can help me get the rest. The projection, minerals development takes many years to occur. Starting from a discovery to a new mine is probably 7 or 8 years. So what you're seeing in the income at the top are projections of what we think will be mined on our property for existing operations that are already permitted and already active. Okay, from 1 year to another, companies such as MinTac will mine more or less of state property, and if they don't mine state property, they will mine private minerals from somebody else, and so on. So what you have there at the top is simply our projection of income as we could best guess it for what the companies would be mining on state property in those years. It does not assume any enhancement at that point at all. So the $420,000 down below that you see as enhancement would not show up in income for probably 7 to 10 years at the earliest, because it just takes that long for a new mine to get involved and get discovered, get developed, get permitted, get the capital investment and all of those things that go with it. So that's the answer on the income. And what's in the base for minerals management? You asked me the $1,526,000. That's the basic. Lease negotiations, lease management. Once the company is mining our property, we inspect and make sure that we're getting our fair share of the production, and that they're paying us the proper rates. It's the mineral potential mapping that we do to interest companies to come do exploration. It's the all of the activities associated with what you do in minerals management, and it is the base funding for the division on minerals. And I don't want to deceive anybody. That's what's unique about this, or different, or what people hate the most, or whatever. But it is the base funding for the division as it currently stands. The $420,000 are mostly things that we used to do and that we should be doing if we want a long-term mineral income to continue into the future. And those are things, this is an example. The first thing on there is drill core analysis. We have a drill core library that has millions of feet of drilling in it. And a few years ago, one of our geologists found a drill core that had a high amount of platinum in it. And that platinum led to an exploration program. The exploration program led to a fair amount of drilling. And today, the company who originally, who leased it after we found it, is now proposing to sink a shaft on the site and do a more assessment, and someday, and it happens to be on school trust land, this section 36. And so someday, we think that will generate income, but it's not included in what we have here. We think we should be continuing to do that work, and we haven't been doing it since 2001 because of budget cuts. And so that's the kind of thing that's in the enhancement. It will not result in income tomorrow or the next day, but it will long-term, we believe, result in income to the school trust, the university, or whatever land type that discovery is made on.
Quick follow-up? Yes, Representative Jemmer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. That was very good, and that does help. One of the additional questions I have, the $420,000 for enhancement, and it seems to be project-oriented from the documents here. It's saying, and I like that. I was looking for that, and it was here, and I was pleased to see it. In 08, that $420,000 gets rolled into management expenditures. It was projects to begin with, specifically. Is that to assume the projects will be ongoing, or you're rolling that $420,000 into management expenditure, which is a pretty hefty increase if you're looking at the management things being done for $1.5 million will turn into $1.9 million in 2008.
28%?
Yes, Madam Chair, Representative, it is a hefty increase, but you also should remember that we've taken about a 30% decrease in minerals management since 2001. And so many of these things we did do in the past as part of our regular program, and they were effective. So that's why I think the enhancement is a good thing to do. Is it too big of an increase? I can't answer that question. But is it? You wanted to ask about projects. In our division, we manage programs by projects, and so I rolled this into the base funding, and each 2 years, we would look at these projects, decide if these should be continued or if others should replace them. And let me give you one example. On the second page, permitting and environmental review, I would expect that project after a couple years would not continue, because right now we have more mineral development proposals than any time in the history of the division. And we're short-staffed because we've had to cut people. And this would help us get through this window of a couple of years of increased funding, and then we would try to figure out what the most important other project that we should do to enhance the minerals income. And we would like to report back to you in 2 years on how this goes, because we think that's important to be accountable for what we're proposing, and also to tell you what we would do in the next 2 years, even though it's part of the base budget. We would still be happy to tell you about the projects we're going to pursue.
But it looks to me, Mr. Bryce, like gradually the trust lands are going to be picking up the total cost of the minerals management division?
Madam Chair, no, that's
not quite.
The total cost of the minerals part is about $2.4 million, of which $1.5 million is the part that we're spending on income generating. The remainder is spent on other activities, working with counties, and also on activities such as sand and gravel, which are not minerals but part of the surface. And so we do sand and gravel inventories, and all of those things ultimately lead to new development, but they don't specifically relate to the minerals income generation line. So those are outside of this proposal.
All right, thank you. Representative Dabney. Getting my ministers and my reps all confused here.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Bryce, I think you're answering this question in different ways, but I guess I need to ask you, have you taken another whack at the ball here?
Okay.
A 20% administration and management fee strikes me as extraordinarily high. I look at the Minneapolis School District with 38,000 students and 80 or 90 schools and buses and all of that that managed to administer the whole shoot and match for somewhere between 4 and 5% of revenue. 20% strikes me as just extraordinarily high. Can you respond, please?
Yes, Madam Chair.
Mr. Bryce.
Representative, 20% is the number we chose because in 1945, tax force.
Were you here at this time? At that time?
No. No, Mr. Luckily, I was. But in 1945, the legislature established 20% as the management fee for tax forfeited minerals. And we manage the tax forfeited minerals for the counties and local tax industries. And so we chose that number. And then we also said we don't know if 20% is too high or the right number. And so that's why there's the return on the account. Once it exceeds $3 million, excess money goes back. And so we think over a number of years, we will figure out what the right management fee is. Now, the other part of your question, though, is minerals similar to managing schools? And I don't know much about schools, but as far as minerals go, there's a lot of pre-work needed before a discovery becomes a mine. And it's both work that the state has to do geologic mapping and interest exploration companies and maintain data that's been collected in the state. We have a drill core library that has all of the drilling done on the range since the 1800s, for example. And amazingly, we still use it. But so it's that kind of work. So I think it is fairly expensive to manage minerals, and so I don't think 20% is particularly high. But if you think of it in the opposite way, that last year we spent $1,526,000 to manage minerals, and our return on investment was $20 million. And if you look at that as a private industry stock, our stock would be just skyrocketing right now. So I guess I don't have a total answer, but that'd be my comments.
Madam Chair, one more question.
Representative,
thank you. Mr. Rice, I'm looking at page 3, line 11, where you refer to mercury research. Could you just explain briefly what that means in this context?
Madam Chair, would it be okay if I boogied? I've got to run up to get vote on an important bill that's just coming to a close.
I think Mr. Bryce is handling it extremely well.
Boogie on.
But Madam Chair, we do want to see him boogie out the room. Go ahead and boogie.
All those in favor? Boogie.
All right, let's see. We were back at a question on
The question of what does the phrase mercury research mean in this context?
Madam Chair.
Mr. Bryce.
Madam Chair, the new air quality standards and water quality standards for mercury air have come on the scene since about 1990 to today. And they're very more and more difficult to meet. The taconite operations have a tiny bit of mercury in their ore, but most of the mercury is in their fuel that they use to process it. And one of the issues that, one of the necessary things that keeps the mines operating is for them to be able to meet the mercury standard. And so we have been working with PCA for the last couple of years to work with the companies on technology that would remove mercury from their stack emissions, and also to assure that the mercury from the water is sequestered in their tailings basins. And so that's the kind of research that we've been doing. It's a cooperative program with the PCA and the industry. And it's funded, it's been funded in the past under either a program we call Environmental Co-op or Iron Ore Co-op.
Thank you. Representative Cleansing, I know you wanted to make a point before, and I missed you.
Thank you.
Will apply?
Yeah, it does. Okay. It is on these projects, one of which is the Mercury project that was just being discussed. The project's listed for an additional $420,000 of management fee costs. Are they exclusively school and university land trust projects, or do these projects also benefit other things that your division works on?
Madam Chair, Representative, these are exclusive to all of the lands that we manage. We manage school, university, tax forfeited, and acquired. And the fee, remember, is being charged to all of those accounts, not just the school or university. So they benefit all of the accounts, and we manage lands for all of our different clients. School being one of them, university is another, and tax forfeit is our other big one.
Follow up, Madam Chair.
Representative.
How many staff do you currently have on board that are working with the school land trust?
Madam Chair, Representative.
Mr. Price.
We don't have, our staff is not split so that it works with school or works with university or works with tax forfeited. Our staff is basically about, and I might have to correct this number, around 38. And that deals with all of these activities on all of the land. School, university, tax forfeited. So we don't have five people that are just working on tax forfeited. We have a staff of researchers and scientists and permitters and mineral engineers and so on that work on all of the lands that we manage. We manage about 12 million acres of mineral rights, and of that 12 million acres, I think it's like 4.5 million are school. A relatively small quantity are university, although they're at the moment earning a large income. And then the rest of it is mostly tax forfeited, and about 1.5 million of acquired.
All right, Representative Greiling.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Bryce, I know, is an honorable person, and I'm sure he's got his back against the wall to come up with this proposal. You know, it's very hard to watch the budget cuts that have gone on at DNR, and then you're unable to maximize and leverage the school trust fund dollars because of not being able to do the work that's needed in these projects that are here. So then we have this proposal before us as a second choice to just plain funding the management of this fund through the general fund, and that would be my first choice, and I suspect everybody's first choice in this committee. And by default, then, we're asked to look at not having the school trust funds managed well and money leveraged with this huge return on investment, or taking money away from school children. You know, that's the way I see the choice that we have here. And I don't really like those choices. I wish that, you know, that we could just go back to funding the DNR as we should, responsibly for the school children. And my question for Mr. Bryce is, if you care to comment on my assessment and see if I'm wrong, and then also, do you believe that we are following the charge that we have in the Constitution and also in the Legislative Auditor's Report on the school trust funds by following this path? In other words, maximizing dollars for the school children.
Madam Chair?
Mr. Bryce.
Representative, the first question is, you know, we've always funded out of general fund, and that's been great. And generally, in the up until about 2000, we were adequately funded out of general fund. And I could come in front of you or anybody else and say, we're doing the kind of work that needs to be done for the long-term investment for the school trust fund or the university trust fund or whatever has it. But since that time, the general fund has had shortages. Our funding has dropped significantly, to the point where I don't believe we're doing the job we should be doing, or I wouldn't have all these extra projects. And this is an alternative. This is a governor's initiative. This is not a department budget cut. And it's an alternative to use a portion of the revenues from these accounts versus using the general fund. And it frees up about $3 million worth of general fund money in exchange for using the 20% revenues of $1.5 million, 26 times 2, $3 million. And that's a policy decision for you folks to make. Is the general fund okay? All I can tell you is that if the minerals program continues to be cut like it has been in the past few years, we're to the point where we're not doing the things that we ought to do to make sure you're getting the best return you can get. And I think that's also a legitimate policy decision that you folks in the legislature are stuck with.
Point.
And so that's the first part. I don't even remember the second question.
Well, Madam Chair.
Representative Browning.
Mr. Bryce, I can't thank you, Madam Chair, Mr. Bryce. I don't remember the second part either, but I will just leave it at this. I will leave it at this. I think with both choices, whether we leave it as it is and we're not maximizing the revenue, the school children lose. If we do it this way, the school children also lose. And I don't think we as policymakers are responsible to only have those kind of choices before us. I think we have to look at general fund revenue available and do something about that and not make these devil's choices for school children.
Representative Erickson, to this point.
Yes, thank you, Representative Sikora. I disagree with you, Representative Greiling, but that aside, Mr. Bryce, will you provide us with the historical background of how the general fund dollars were used to enhance mineral management, let's say over the last dozen years, you know, at least going back to 1990, so we can see whether or not the DNR was as aggressive as they should have been in, you know, the title research. I know that's been a huge problem, looking for new metallic minerals, especially in the northern part of our state where we need economic development, so that we can trace that, because I think part of our problem is that the status quo reigned free during a number of years, and we probably should have done this 12 or 15 years ago. Thank you. Mr. Bryce.
Madam Chair, Representative, over the last, let me go back to like about 1990. At that time, there were several things happening.
Madam Chair, I would like this in a written form so we don't have to discuss it today. If he would provide us with that, thank you.
You know, Mr. Bryce, we're not going to get through all of this because there also are some initiatives that we wanted to discuss today. We're still on the original, and I have a number of questions left, more than have been answered thus far. So I'm not quite sure when we bring this up again, and I don't know what your availability would be later this afternoon, possibly, or something like that.
Madam Chair, I'm available at 12:30.
You are available?
Yes, I canceled my other things because it didn't seem like timing was going to work out today.
That was a brilliant move, Mr.
Credibility was up.
Because then I think we will probably bring this back up. We will continue for as long as we can here, but it's obvious that we're barely going to get through this proposal, much less some of the proposals that we have to enhance revenues in addition to this piece. So, Representative Heidgerken, you're finally next.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair. And, again, a couple of questions, Mr. Bryce. Why, you know, is it true that exploration for minerals, they found some good leading indicators of some possible great finds, especially with the Pioneer Press did a nice write-up about 2 weeks ago and made the front page. And there's some very good possibilities with some of the nickel and everything else. They found that the lucrative market all of a sudden. And because of that, I see legislation coming forth that would perhaps like to get into the percentage of those revenues that might be rising. I look upon the management of, I'd like to bring Representative Rukavina in here. Him and I have had some long discussions on how the forest lands are managed and a percentage increase over time there, but we're not going to go there now. But I'm a little bit worried about when we see the possibilities of some a lot of money all of a sudden coming in, and all of a sudden there's legislation of trying to capture a certain percentage of that. It seems like it's coming at a convenient time. I still like the accountability of the money coming out of the general revenue. If I would have to vote on this, I would have to go back to my constituents and said, I took dollars away from kids and gave it to rocks. And I mean, it's just, I have one follow-up. If you would just comment on that, you know, the exploration finds that they've had. And
Madam Chair, Representative, exploration has been is also cyclical in Minnesota, and it depends a lot on what the value of the metals are out there. We have had we have had recent discoveries of some evaluations of copper nickel. Copper nickel is located along the Duluth complex from Hoyt Lakes up past Babbitt, and there are four or five deposits. The state has significant holdings in at least two of them that are currently active. One of them is the school trust land at Section 36 and the Lehman proposal, which is the shaft sinking, and the other one is the old AMAC site just south of Babbitt, and that has copper, nickel, platinum, palladium, and a few other trace metals in it. There's also a lot of activity that continues to go on in the state on other metals like zinc and nickel, and there's a current exploration south of Mille Lacs Lake and also in western Minnesota along with the area of the northeastern part of the state. The article you heard about was diamonds. And diamonds were always thought to be in a certain part of the world, and they were never thought to be in this part of the world until there was a discovery in Canada, northern Canada, about a decade ago. And they discovered kimberlite pipes in the Canadian Shield. And we have the Canadian Shield that goes from Duluth, kind of diagonally across the state, down to about where the Minnesota River starts. And all of that land to the north has Canadian Shield. So there are companies that now are interested in diamonds here. On the industrial mineral side, there's interest in Dimension Stone here. There are two new quarries, and there's interest in at least one or more sites. There's also been some activity, huge activity in the area I haven't talked about today, which is part of the surface, which is sand and gravel and crushed stone. And then there's also activity in horticultural materials for landscaping, boulders, flat rocks to walk on or sit on, slates, all of those kinds of things. And we have started doing business in all of those areas in recent years.
Representative Diskins.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Madam Chair, Mr. Bryce, I said this was an out-of-the-box proposal, and I appreciate that. I'm going to try my hand at a little out-of-the-box proposal, something I rarely do. Mr. Bryce, if the primary beneficiary of the success of the fund is actually education, right, be it the university or the K-12 system, I'm wondering if we are truly looking at maximizing the revenue. I would think that the people most vested in seeing its success would be those who are most interested at seeing the maximum return. Why would it not be, Mr. Bryce, a good idea to go ahead and do this, but in so doing also add a very short and simple amendment to this piece of legislation, which then transfers this division over to the Department of Education?
Mr. Bryce.
Well, Madam Chair, Representative, it's been suggested that we be transferred to a variety of places in the past. education is the first time that I've heard that proposal. It's true that on the school and university, those lands were given to the state for education. On the tax forfeited lands, of course, those are lands that are for the local taxing districts, and on the other lands, they're for other people. Somewhere you need... On minerals, you need a group of mineral specialists together to do this kind of management. And exactly where it has to be, it can be probably anywhere. But I would argue that at the Department of Natural Resources, when we go through like permitting on a new mining operation, we have to deal with the environmental review that's in ecological services. We have to deal with the water, and which is in the Division of Waters, water quality at the PCA, fish and wildlife impacts, on the land and other uses of the land, which are, you know, other parts. And it kind of makes sense for us to be doing that in conjunction with everybody else. Now, remember also that we also manage the real estate aspects and the forest aspects of school trust. So, and those are all at the DNR. But, you know, wherever you want to put us, as long as we get a chance to do a good job and manage these minerals, we're not too...
Representative Newt Demmer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I guess my question really related to the $3 million balance and how that was arrived at. I've been reading through the materials, and it looks like you're looking at about 2 years worth of expenditures. Is $3 million the amount that's really necessary to have there as a cushion as opposed to a projected $1 million extra or something like that?
Madam Chair, Representative, I don't know what the
Mr.
right
Bryce.
Number is. We picked that because we wanted to make sure that during downturns in the economy there would be enough. So we wouldn't be coming back here and saying, hey, we can't keep the regular people who are supposed to be doing this job on the job. If it's too much, it might be, then we ought to reduce it at some point. So that was our best guess. And maybe it should be 2.5 or 2, or I think 1 is probably too small because this business, our income can vary by, we've never made $20 million before. Our income has generally been in the $8 to $12.5 million range. And our income can easily vary by a couple of million dollars from 1 year to the next, very easily. And you can even see it on these reports that we're projecting differences of several million dollars. So, I don't know.
Mr. Bryce, we have one last very quick question. We have to get our tails out of here because taxes, I believe, comes in. I was thinking of our 12:30 time when we don't have to be out till a quarter after, so my mind was still at a 12:30 meeting time. Representative Dorn.
Thank you, Madam Chair. It will be very brief because I fear that Representative Biskins will move even further out of the box and decide children are the greatest natural resource, so the Department of Education should be moved into that. just in the information that you that Representative Erickson asked for, because there is, in my mind, a little confusion just over what is the budget for management versus the investment component, and that just kind of a summary of what your funding has been in terms of the budget would be helpful to me as well, in terms of what you've been getting over the years and what the 30% reduction referred to and that sort of thing. Thank you, Madam Chair.
We are in recess until 12:30. The committee will reconvene, and I would like to call Representative Leader up first for his bill. That is House File 2242, and the chair will move House File 2242 to before the committee and considered for possible inclusion in the bill. And Representative Leader, thank you for your patience. I know you were on the agenda this morning, and we ran quite behind. And I thank you for being here.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Madam Chair and members, House File 2242 deals with a local problem, not a problem, but we have a combined school district that is basically two small communities, and they had old schools that were really in bad shape. And at that time, you had your special legislation for ADA monies, and there was a levy within the school district in the 94-95, and then subsequently they did decide where they're going to locate it in between the cities, and they built a new school. The new school is built, and that complies with ADA requirements. And what this does, they had a balance. They did use some of their monies in the old schools to bring it up, to try to bring it up to date before they built. They didn't realize they're going to be building that quickly because they had communities had those community fights. What happens now, there's a balance of $87,000 roughly in their reserved account for disabilities, I believe that's what you call it, and they'd like to transfer that to their general fund. That's basically the bill, Madam Chair.
Representative Leader, would you know, is your district in statutory operating debt or anything like that?
I'm sorry, Madam Chair. It was one of the things that I asked and I didn't get. I forgot about it, frankly.
That's all right. I think probably Mr. Crow can find that if we give him a couple of minutes. Are there questions from anyone else on the committee? It just is helpful to know a few of those things. You won't be needing to modernize any buildings?
Madam Chair, no. They have brand new buildings, and they spent a little bit in 2001 just to some minor adjustment. And it's basically a new building, a one-story building, so they pretty much are in compliance all the way.
And Winnie Mac stands for which district?
Winger, McIntosh, and Erskine. It's a combined school district, three
right.
schools. It used to be three districts.
All right, it's just hard to remember what they all stand for now that they don't have real names now. All right, did Mr. Crowder? We're getting there.
Okay, question.
Representative Heidberg.
Thank you, Representative Leader, and thank you for bringing this forth. And it's very similar. I think we've had now in the committee, I think we've had about 50 requests for fund transfers. And I think the message that we're getting is, and I think we all know that, and we're trying to come up with a solution, is that especially on our state, we're really short on funds, and they're scrambling to get a hold of any funds they can. And because of state statute, sometimes there's money's laying there that takes legislative approval to do so. And so hopefully we can take care of yours as well as among a whole bunch of others that we got to look at.
All right. I know that we have discovered we are not in statutory operating debt, nor were you last year. I don't know if you were before that. So that's, and whatever we do, if we were to allow you to transfer, you know, we do have to pay for that because that was money that was supposed to go back to your district because it was levied and not used. So it was supposed to be returned, which means that we would have to carry that in our bill as a levy cost. So, you know, any of these that we do, that's, I think, Mr. Newman, Representative Newman generally asks that question. So, are there any... Representative Demmer, you had a question still? Go ahead.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Leader, do you know if Winnemac is taking this out of the reserve account for disability access? Is there absolutely no need for using those funds for that purpose any longer in that school district?
Representative Leader.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Madam Chair and Representative Demmer, that's correct. They had two old school buildings prior to building the new one. And they had a levy for that, and they accommodated some of the problems they had. And it's with the small communities, they're about 10 miles apart, three of them. They couldn't determine about building a new school or locating it, and they finally did. And in the process, they had that levy, and they had spent some of the monies. And after they built the new school, that's in compliance with ADA, and they just had an inspection again in 2001. So they don't have any need for that disability access monies presently.
Madam Chair.
Representative Demmer.
And this question probably is for either Mr. Crow or Mr. Strom, but we don't levy for disabled access anymore, is that correct?
Madam Chair, Representative Demmer, that's right. It was a one-time levy for up to $300,000 per district.
Okay, and could you remind...
Over 8 years.
Okay, and could you remind me the monies that are left there at some point? Is there a drop-dead time or a time that they have to use it or lose it type of deal, and where would it go or anything like that?
Madam Chair, Representative Demmer, if the district determines that the money is not necessary under the current process, the department would certify a levy reduction in the following year once the district determined they no longer needed that funding.
And would it then be transferred to their capital account or whatever other levy, their like debt levy or something like that? Would it transfer into there and lower that levy?
Madam Chair, Representative Demmer, it would reduce their other general fund levy since the disabled access account is in the general fund. So it would be a levy reduction. The revenue would be lost to the school district through a levy reduction.
Okay, and when would that happen? Do we have a date yet?
Madam Chair, Representative Demmer, that would happen after the department becomes aware that there's a balance that won't be used. There are a number of districts with balances, and the department does not have a policy or procedure of requiring districts to reduce those in a certain number of years. It's essentially ongoing balances, and the department presumes that they're going to be used unless they're sold differently.
Yeah, thank you.
Madam Chair.
Representative.
Madam Chair, and pardon me, Representative Leader, but I would like to carry on this conversation with Mr. Strom just a little bit further, if you don't mind, Madam Chair. Mr. Strom, Yeah, when we talk about levy reduction, obviously that means the intent was to go back to the taxpayers. Is that essentially what happens with a levy reduction?
Madam Chair, Representative Distance, yes, when the district certified the levy a number of years ago, the reason that they were able to certify the levy is because they said it was for the purpose of making disabled access repairs to facilities. So if the money is not used, just as it is in other areas, if the money is not used for those purposes, then essentially that funding needs to cancel back at some point in time and the levy is reduced.
Madam Chair.
Representative Biskin.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Madam Chair and Mr. Strom, I'm going to ask if you were here at the time of this levy enactment, and if you recall the conversations, was this part of the discussion? Was it specifically the intent of the legislature in your mind that they really wanted to keep the use of this levy very narrow?
Madam Chair, Representative Fiskins, this provision was added to the bill in conference committee from a Senate division. And the provision, as I remember, I believe it was 1991 or 1992, the provision had 5-year time limit on it and $300,000 of authority per district, regardless of district size or need for the projects. It was not long after some of the ADA legislation at the federal level had passed. So there weren't any discussions, to my knowledge, in the House of that provision prior to that point in time. After the first year, many, many districts had used the full amount in the first year. So it's only come to our attention in the last few years, after the 8 years that run, that some districts have these balances left. And there hasn't been, to my knowledge, a good discussion of whether they should all be canceled at one time or whether they can essentially stay out there until the district needs to do a project.
Final question, Madam Chair.
Representative Biskin.
Final question then, Mr. Strom. To the best of your knowledge, has the department actually told any district in the state of Minnesota you must reduce your levy to remove that fund balance?
Madam Chair, Representative Biskin, I'm not aware of them telling any district that they need to do that.
Okay, thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Representative Newman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. To piggyback on Representative Biskin's questions, Mr. Strom, is there any requirement that the citizens of a particular school district are receive any kind of notice that we're not going to give them their money back if we were to go along with this kind of a request?
Mr. Strom.
Madam Chair, Representative Newman, because the initial levy information when the levy was certified for many districts back in the early 90s, it showed up then as part of the truth and taxation process. There was an increase in the local district's levy for that purpose. It's presumed that these funds will stay in account balances until the projects for which they were initially approved are completed. So there's no notification that's gone to the citizens in the district suggesting that there's a balance in that fund and that it may be reduced. It would only be if the district took the step of reducing that levy that would show up as part of the truth in taxation materials.
All right. One more question. Representative Heidgerken.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I had a question previous to Representative Biskin, so some of the things were answered. I look upon this, I would think, and Mr. Strom, if you could help me with it, are there quite a few school districts, like I'm looking at, I always use Minnewaska as an example, they're closing a couple of buildings, they may have money laying aside, but the buildings are no longer going to be used. Are there a lot of school districts in the state of Minnesota that have these funds sitting there that could be helping educate our kids in one way or another? Now, Representative Leader is looking at transferring these funds into the Reserved Operating Capital Fund. Are there a lot of money? I look upon this as a good way of using money that's allocated out there. They may be just sitting there not doing anything. This could be a help for a lot of the school districts. I mean, the governor's looking at a discretionary levy. This levy has already been approved by the voters in the district. Does there seem to be a lot of monies like that?
Madam Chair, Representative Heidgerken, we have a file from a year and a half ago, and at that point in time, there were about 109 districts with some levy authority left and that had not been utilized, and that amount is about $20 million statewide. So, for example, the reason for that may have been in, as in Representative Leader's case, if a district initially levied to make an improvement like an elevator to a school and then closed that school and built a new school, that improvement wasn't necessary because the differential in heights between parts of the building wasn't there. So that's a large part of why these balances exist. And in your case, it's my understanding that Minnewaska does have a balance in the disabled access account. And again, they fit that criteria of having built a new school, so that they may have received the levy authority in the early 90s prior to them constructing the new secondary school. And so they no longer needed to make those improvements. And so they've still got that balance in their accounts.
And there is no mandated time then in which they're supposed to return the unused levy. It just can sit there for quite, in this case, just in the case of the disability levy.
Madam Chair, yes. This money is essentially a reserved amount of money for the district. It's in a reserved account, but there's not a time limit that says that it has to be used within a certain number of years.
All right. Thank you. There being no other questions, Representative Leader, thank you. It took a few minutes longer than the three you promised me. But I don't think it was your fault, Representative Leader.
Thank you
very much.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
And this bill will be laid over for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill. And so we will, at this time, go back to House File 1133 that was before us when we broke for recess. And I'll ask Mr. Bryce to come back up. Representative Cornish can't be here, but I believe all the questions were directed to Mr. Bryce in any case. So I think we will be able to handle that just fine. And Representative Newman, you were on the list at the time we recessed. Do you remember? Do you still have a question for Mr. Bryce?
I'll try. Thank you, Madam Chair. I had intended my question to be very brief. Essentially, what I'm looking for is a yes or no answer. Just see if that's really what I'm looking for. And so I'm really not looking for anything long. Am I correct that in this management account that we've been discussing, we're going to fund it with 20% of the funds, up to a maximum of $3 million in that account? Is that correct?
Madam Chair, yes.
One follow-up question.
See, he's a lawyer. He doesn't keep his word.
So do I get any rebuttal time on that one, Madam Chair?
Representative Newman, I didn't mean that.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Bryce, yes or no? I'm looking at four different categories of mineral types of land that are being managed. School trust, university trust, tax forfeited, and other. Is the $3 million that is going to go into this account, this management account, is the management account going to be funded essentially on a prorated basis from those four different categories?
Madam Chair, that's correct.
Mr. Bryce.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Representative Clinton.
Thank you, Madam Chair. For those tax forfeiture lands that your department manages, what percentage of the land is the tax forfeiture land, and then where do you see those management costs coming out of which part of the budget?
Madam Chair, Representative.
Mr. Bryce.
Tax forfeited land, we manage about 12 million acres. The majority of them are tax forfeited minerals. I told you this morning that trust fund was 4.5. I made a mistake. It was 3.5 million acres. Ad acquired at 1.5 million roughly acres. That's 3.5 plus 1.5 is 5. And then almost all the rest of them are tax forfeited. The University Trust is a very small amount of land, but it's in a very good spot.
it'd be like 100,000 or a couple hundred thousand acres.
In other words, their land is a little more valuable than ours.
Madam Chair,
Representative Cleansing.
So are you saying that all of the tax forfeited lands are either in the school lands trust or in the university trust and none of them are outside of those trusts?
Madam Chair, no.
Mr. Bryce.
When we manage the tax forfeited lands, we manage those for the counties.
Mm-hmm.
And so they're separate. They're the third kind of land that's shown in the top table. And they're being proportioned the income and the management fee based on their relative income, 20% of it.
Madam Chair?
Representative Plensing.
So then just to confirm, you're saying the counties are paying 20%. You're getting that management fee from the counties directly and no other source?
Madam Chair, since 1945, the counties, 20% of the cost of managing, of the income for managing tax forfeited goes to the general fund. And then that general fund is part of our reappropriation for our base budget. So the counties have been paying 20% since 1945.
All right, the questions that we've had, and we've run out of questions on this particular... Okay, we have a whole... No, that's fine. Representative Piedgrier can go ahead. I didn't know that you were still on.
Yes, I'm just going back to... and I'm trying to reestablish where this all comes from, okay? And I need a clarification on this, and you can correct me on this. My interpretation of the trust funds... basically go to a permanent school fund right now where everything is set up. And it's a responsibility of the legislature to oversee this. We've got the DNR managing it, right? And supposedly that there's a state exec council that approves the mineral leasing activities. And there's also a permanent school fund advisory committee which reviews the DNR activities and recommends changes. We also have a State Board of Investment and Department of Finance that manages a PSF. My question then is, apparently you're looking at a change in statute in order for you to be able to do what you want to do. Because my interpretation is that the last time this was attempted, the Attorney General ruled against this because it was against the Constitution. And my interpretation was that you cannot use income for money earmarked for education in this fashion, according to the last ruling by the Attorney General. Am I right or wrong on this?
Madam Chair,
Mr. Bryce.
Representative, the last ruling by the Attorney General was in, I believe, 2001 or 2002, and it was for a mineral research account, and he ruled that you could use management fees, you could take management fees from the revenue to manage minerals. I have the opinion if that would help the committee.
Why, Madam Chair? Why do we need a statute change then to do what you want to do? Because it's going to change the statute 16A.125.
We need a statute change to create the fund, the mineral management account.
Madam Chair, was this where the Attorney General came and ruled against you because you didn't have the statute in play?
Mr. Bryce.
Madam Chair, Representative, the Attorney General hasn't ruled against me in quite a long time.
Okay.
on this topic. I get some land up that occasionally is different. But there are two opinions that I'm aware of. One that are kind of the last 15 years. One of them was in the mid-90s when... university trust fund land was the trust fund revenue was used for 1 year to help balance the budget when there was a shortfall in general fund, and that was and that opinion was about 95, and that supported using that money. And then there was an opinion for the taconite grant program in 2001 or two, and I'm not sure which year it was, and that also supported using the money. So if there's an opinion that opposes that, they're older than those two opinions.
Okay, Madam Chair.
What
would be the administrative charges for managing gravel that this would be passed. I'm looking at what you're charging right now with administrative costs for timber. It's gone up remarkably. I mean, and the percentage is quite high. What would be the administrative cost for something like that?
Madam Chair, Representative, gravel is a part of the surface estate, not part of the mineral estate.
Mm-hmm.
And we manage gravel currently in our real estate side of the Division of Lands and Minerals. And we're going to actually talk about gravel here in a couple minutes.
Okay.
But we do not have an administrative charge for any of the real estate items currently. The only administrative charge that that I'm aware of on the real estate side from the past was to support the Lakeshore Sales and Exchange Program that occurred from about late 80s to 2001 or 2. And there we were allowed to use some of the lease revenue from that from the Lakeshore lots to take care of our management fee for sales and exchanges.
Okay, just one
follow-up. Representative Heidgerken.
How come it doesn't cost the DNR any money to manage wildlife lands, and it costs 60% of the sales and timber lands? Why the major discrepancies?
Mr. Bryce.
I'm really not the person to answer that question, but it costs money to manage wildlife lands. It comes from the game and fish account, and it's appropriated just like general fund is appropriated to forestry to manage forestry. Now, whether it's a bigger or smaller percentage, I don't know, but both of them receive money for managing those lands.
Okay, but it seems quite high in when you compare the two. Are we going to be continuing? He's going to talk about gravel and some other things. I'll just hold my question.
Well, I have the bill for the aggregate that I had last, that I carried 2 years ago, that or last year, I guess, that we didn't end up passing.
But
because
with this
of the
bill,
year.
This would be yet. I just have.
No, there's another issue I want to bring up on this bill, but you go ahead, Representative.
All right. Just following up, we're looking at alternatives. You're looking at the. Basically, the initiative that you have there will shift the current cost of mineral management from the general fund, and I kind of like it there right now because apparently there's a lot of things in play. There's about four or five different boards looking at this money apparently, and we're taking it out of the general and we want to take it out of education all of a sudden. And I always like it going back to where it's not a direct hit on education. We have to look at the alternatives now. And the only alternative that I like is maintaining the status quo, using general fund dollars to finance basically mineral management on state trust funds. You're looking at an alternative that would fund dollars for the DNR. And basically the winner would be, when I look at this, the incentives are great for the DNR that for this to pass, or they have the statute change, and education is the loser. I don't see it any other way. And that's just a general comment. And I just look at who's winning and who's losing, and the DNR will be the winner on this one.
Madam Chair.
Mr. Price.
Obviously, that's a policy decision that you have to make. The reason this bill was drafted was because long-term, the general fund budget for the Division of Minerals has been rocketing downwards. And we're to the point where we're not doing all of the things that we should be doing to properly manage minerals. And so that's the purpose of this. So what do you do? We can't ask for more general fund money, and so it was recommended that we ask for a different alternative, and we have done that. And you know, we think minerals needs to be fully funded because of the revenue and the long-term potential here. And I, you know, exactly how you do it, I guess that's kind of the legislature's.
Okay. I'm
stuck with that.
I agree with you, you know, but when I go back to my district, and we look at where the DNR is spending money, I mean, we just had Lake Christina in my district to spend over $1 million trying to clean up a lake that they didn't do and lost a helicopter doing it. I have a problem with the DNR managing anybody's money, much less education money. I mean, the DNR, I go back home and I take on the DNR, I pick up all kinds of votes. I mean, no offense meant to you, Mr. Bryson, I'm just...
Well, thank you, Representative Heidgerken. Would you put a cool hand to his forehead, please? All right, I'd like to call your attention. I think we've listened to this. I told you we would lay this over for the moment so that we can all discuss this a little bit further. But I want you to look at also what this was talking about was a management fund of $1.5 million. and $1.5 million essentially for the next 2 years. In addition to that, there's $420,000 included per year. That's not part of the 1.5, that would be an addition. That would be minerals enhancement. In other words, exploring for new ways to maybe bring money into the trust fund, which I think might be something we ought to look at. And I wondered if you would quickly, Mr. Bryce, address that and, you know, kind of what you have in mind for minerals enhancement. I know you mentioned earlier was it platinum, copper, nickel, a few things like that, but...
Madam Chair, I'd be happy to. In the handout you had this morning on the back page, starts on the back page of the tables. The first one was the one we talked about, the drill core analysis. That's something we used to do, we don't do currently. The second one was the land and title work. Now we only do land and title work when someone is either trying to take the state minerals away from us, or we're trying to make sure that that we have a claim when we know we have a reserve. And so we do very little of that. Some of the other activities you see on there, but these are the projects that we would work on for the next 2 years for the $420,000. Some of these projects we have done in the past and need to continue to do, and some of these projects would be new. For example, the value-added iron and coal gas production project. We have worked on value-added things in the past, but that program was basically stopped about 3 or 4 years ago, and there's new technology that happens to fit Minnesota's low-grade iron ore and low BTU Western coal. And so it's a project that has some potential here in Minnesota, and we ought to look at it. We need to look at the environmental issues and the economic issues and so on. So there's some new, some things we've done in the past, and we think these are the right things to do to make the minerals revenue long-term continue in a reasonable path and maybe even increase. And just one little comment to my friend representative. I can't see his name.
A German name.
You know, we're spending $1.5 million, and we're earning $20 million this year, and that's pretty good. But that's only the minerals part. So you know, a friend of mine once said, "There's good cholesterol and there's bad cholesterol," and that's all the more I want to say.
I won't start again, Madam Chair.
All right. If you would look at the sheet that was passed out, revenue enhancements on school lands, down at the bottom is a list of some other types of things that could be done that might, you know, that we would have to pay for, but that might bring us additional money. I'm not sure that any of these are a sure thing, but I thought Mr. Bryce ought to address those. And so more of your consideration would be if we want to do the $400,000 that is being suggested here for minerals enhancement, and then under the other enhancements, the school land inventories, you know, I don't know exactly what kind of inventory they're talking about, so I guess he'll tell us, et cetera. They're on the bottom of the sheet that was just passed out, okay? So if you would address those quickly,
yep.
Mr. Bryce, I would be...
Madam Chair, all morning we talked about the mineral side of the division. The other side of the division is real estate. We manage the real estate aspects of all of the state land that the department is responsible for. And by that I mean leases, easements, utility crossings, buy and sell land based on capital bonding, or sell land based on whatever. So we do all of those kinds of real estate things. And over the last number of years, we spent an incredible amount of time taking care of the lakeshore lot issues here in the state, and you probably are aware of that. And so it seems to me like it's time that we step back a couple of steps and look at this is the school trust fund land, surface management for real estate, and say, are we doing everything we can to maximize income in that area? And that has not really been looked at because in the last decade or so. And so what we have is a proposal here to begin looking at that and to also deal with some particular issues that we know are out there that need to be managed. And there are four things that have been proposed in this initiative. The first would be to do small site-specific inventories to look at additional income that could be developed from sale or exchange or other kinds of management. And we would inventory small sections. For example, maybe the corridor between St. Cloud and the Twin Cities. We own some state land and some of it's school trust. And maybe we ought to look at whether there's a better way to manage some of that. So the inventory part would be to selectively pick some corridors, pilot areas in the state, and to identify what that land is currently being used for and what its potential is. The second thing, a goal here, is to look at new opportunities. In the West, especially, a lot of states also receive school trust land, and they have a much more active school trust real estate management program than we do. They do a fair amount of work in commercial leasing. A number of them have cooperative agreements on residential developments. A couple of the states can actually buy and sell commercial real estate for income generation for the school trust and things like that. So the second proposal in here is to look at the things that are being done in other places and what we're doing and whether we can improve those activities. The third one is one that has been a problem for the department for years. Through management, a number of parcels of state school trust land were placed in management units where income is not possible. For example, there's a number of acres of state lands in state parks. And there's also lands in peat protection areas that were set up by the 1991 Wetlands Protection Act, and so on. And so right now, under our current funding, we have been doing about one land exchange every biennium, which many people have said is a paltry effort at what we should be doing. And so we're proposing that we accelerate those land exchanges by the third project that's listed here. The last project that's listed is additional land sales. We have a very small land program, and if you have happen to be on one of the committees that has like the land sale bill, you'll notice that there's very little trust land that's even being thought of. And if we think if we do a decent inventory in some of these areas, some parcels of land might be appropriate for sale. And again, we would like to explore these objectives and try to see if there are not opportunities to improve the return on the real estate part of the school trust land management. Now, this proposal is exclusively the school trust land. This isn't university or any other lands. This is just the school portion of the lands that we have been talking about all morning. Thank you.
All right. Are there questions about this? Representative Erickson.
Thank you, Chair Sikora. This is not a question, it's a comment, because I know it's so easy to bash the DNR. I have lots of constituents who like to do it, too, and sometimes I also. But, you know, as I think about what we're hearing today, I really think the DNR is looking at reform. And in many instances, I think we have to say, you know, we hold you accountable to take care of our natural resources and spend the taxpayer dollars wisely. But I see in both of these fact sheets that you've given us some thinking out of the box, indeed, and I think ways to maybe enhance our revenue, as I think you're trying to say to us, Mr. Bryce. And, for change, I want to say thank you for at least thinking about these. I'm not sure we're going to agree with them, but, you know, at least you've offered us something from which to work. And for change, you know, I need to say thanks.
You know, I will echo that because Representative Segrin and I, you know, discussed this a great deal with you 2 years ago. And we talked to Commissioner Merriam at the time, and he was interested in trying to improve what we make off the land, because if you look at what we get per acre, it was pretty doggone flimsy. So we thought there has to be something we can do better, and So we asked them to think about what we could do better, and they've come up with, I think, some ideas that we ought to consider.
Okay.
So that's what I'd like you all to think about. You know, look at these, think about which you would like to do. The $1.5 million we will talk about in a separate way, but that is combined university trust cost and permanent school trust fund, the management fee, right?
Yes, and tax forfeited and other.
So you don't know about how much exactly would be our piece?
Well,
about $900,000.
Madam Chair, if you go to the table and you look at 2006, mm-hmm. our best estimate when we put this budget together was that the income for a school would be $9.2 million.
Mm-hmm.
It's this table here. In case you...
Oh, in that top sheet. Okay.
Yep. Right. Top line.
Top line. Yeah.
Our best estimate was school was for 2006 would be $9.2 million, university $5.6 million, tax forfeited.
No,
six,
I'm sorry.
And so on.
You misunderstood me, and I wasn't
okay,
very
sorry.
Clear. I just meant, what is the amount of dollars that would either for the management fee for just the school trust lands per year in the next 2 years. So that's what I was trying to get.
Okay. Madam Chair, what I would do is I would proportion it. If you're talking about 1.5 or 1.9, you would take take the $15 million of total revenue expected and proportion it back to each of the accounts.
Oh,
so okay. So school trust would be around 60%,
right.
University 40%. And I didn't calculate it, so probably my numbers are a little off, but that'd be approximately
okay.
what it would be.
So we're talking about 900 some thousand that would be the school trust share of the 1.5 management fee, plus whatever our share is of the 420 if we did the minerals enhancement or whatever.
Right. If you were only talking about the 1.5 million plus the 420, that's correct.
Representative Heidgerken.
Thank you. I want to get back to where we should be at. No offense meant, Mr. Bryce. Everybody's missing the point here. We have a permanent school, basically, fund set up, the PSF. The PSF has an advisory committee. How come they have not testified? We already have a committee set up. Why aren't these people here that review the DNR activities and recommend changes? Why aren't they here? We got an employee of this of a board that oversees these people. We're not getting any recommendation. Plus, there's a state exec council that approves mineral leasing activities. We have not got any input from them. Plus, above them, there's a state board of investment, and there's a department of finances that manages the DNR has not testified to this. These people all are overlooked by these boards and committees, and we've got no input from them at all.
Right, there is a council. We did meet
right.
last year. We didn't meet this year as yet.
Mm-hmm.
And that is because there have to be new appointees made
mm-hmm.
to that. The automatics are Representative Biskins and Senator Kelly.
Mm-hmm.
They are the two chairs, and then I believe the finance chairs are on it,
mm-hmm.
as well as some superintendents and... Mr. Bryce, help me out.
The Commissioner of Education.
Right, okay.
I think you've got them all then.
Okay. And we have contacted the commissioner to ask her to make the new appointments, but everybody's in session and trying to get a meeting
mm-hmm.
together is not as easy
that.
As you might think.
Okay.
And I didn't realize all of this was actually happening until kind of recently.
So my point
so
is
I apologize. I should have caught on faster mm-hmm. to what was all going on here.
But my point is that they're already being scrutinized. It would be good to get some input from some of these people that have been scrutinizing them. To find exactly why they need a change in statute, et cetera, et cetera. And that's I think we need to get beyond what they want to do is why. And what is the recommendation of the people overseeing them? Their authorities.
Well, we have about 3 days to get this all done, Representative. Scary thought. Representative Erickson.
Thank you, Chair Secor. Representative Heidgerken, and you know, we create all these layers of bureaucracy, so we've got to unlayer them so we can get to the bottom of this question that you have and I have and whether or not this is the best solution. But, you know, we have to take responsibility. We create the layers. Now we've got to unlayer them.
Ultimately, it's our responsibility. as I would say. I just would like you to take out your bill 813. Mr. Bryce is doing a great job sitting up at the table, so I'll just I'll let him continue to hold down the table.
My day.
Yeah, we are laying over. I'm sorry, I thought I made that clear. We are laying over House File 1133, not necessarily for possible inclusion, but to bring up again, because you know, essentially this bill either dies here, we take bits and pieces of it and pass it on over to the Environment Committee, and even higher ed would like to see it, but I guess they're kind of past their deadline, so they're not going to have an opportunity to review this the way we have. So what you have before you, 813, I would like to move House File number 813 before you for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill. Actually, this will be moved. After we decide what we're doing, this will be moved over to Environment Finance. But this is the bill that we had last year that was passed and was in the omnibus bill and, of course, in the omnibus environment bill. And this was for us to take $50,000 from the forest expense account, which would be used for exploration of aggregates. And aggregates, as was mentioned earlier, has become a rather hot commodity. There's somewhat of a scarcity of it, and therefore its value has definitely increased in the last few years. And we think there's probably a lot of those old rocks and gravel and stones up in some of those lands that we have in northern Minnesota. Unfortunately, I wish there was some a little closer to the metropolitan area, but there probably isn't that much down here. And Mr. Bryce, do you want to just comment on what you think the possibilities are here?
Madam Chair, actually one of the projects we worked on is in Bayport, which is real close to the cities, and it's a wildlife management area. Originally part of the a prison system, I think the land was. But what this does is basically allows us to do two or three detailed resource surveys of school trust land properties that we believe have gravel on them, and creates the ability for us to get the best amount of money for them when we lease them by giving us good information about the tonnages that are available, the characteristics of the deposit, and the quality of the gravel. And that gives you a lot more information to allow you to negotiate a good lease. We've had the chance to negotiate two or three leases in the last couple of years, two of them on wildlife lands and one on a recent one on school trust land. The cost of these surveys have been running us around $18,000-$20,000, and the return has been very good. On the wildlife example in Pennington County that we did, the return to date is $380,000 for an $18,000 investment. The wildlife property in Bayport has returned us $349,000. So we think there is a real opportunity here. We recently completed one north of Grand Rapids. The survey cost about $11,000 and then a fair amount of staff time. And we believe that it contains 475,000 cubic yards of gravel, and we leased that for $1.10. That's a little over $500,000. So we think we know of many sites out there that have gravel deposits that maybe have been mined in the past or not that could be developed on state trust land, and we think this is a way to improve income.
Here's what I was thinking, folks. I think we ought to think about this a little bit, maybe talk about it. But if we came back, whatever we decide to do, I thought we could use 813 as the vehicle for whatever and amend in if there are any of the other enhancements or explorations or anything that we wish to do. We've approved the $50,000 before, and it seems like an awfully good investment, quite honestly. So, and at this point, we will just lay this over for a little discussion, and then we will come back and decide what we wish to do. But I'd like a chance to visit with some of you about it informally also, just to see, you know, where you're thinking, how much time is it going to take for us to work through this? Because I hadn't anticipated a four-hour proposition in the last couple of days of hearing bills. So, Mr. Bryce, are there any questions for Mr. Bryce? Any further questions you want to ask him? All right. Representative Erickson.
This is not for Mr. Bryce, but for you, Madam Chair. The A1 amendment, is that something we're going to hold on to then?
That's a beautiful.
The A1 amendment is for $300,000, and that would essentially recommend doing all of the things that were...
So we're just going to hold that, Madam Chair.
So I'm thinking, as long as we're bringing it back, we should think about it. We will bring it back soon because it does have to go over to environment. So we'll bring it back soon. So keep these pieces in your file.
Madam Chair, I helped whoever put the amendment together yesterday, and there's a slight correction on that amendment. You might want to just include in if you bring it back. And what you do is you replace on the fourth line in the permanent school fund, because the forest expense account is not in the permanent school fund. And you replace it with for school trust lands.
Read it again.
You remove in the permanent school fund, and you replace that language with for school trust lands.
Okay.
Because the forest expense account is not in the school, is not in the permanent school fund. And I don't know how that got in there, because I know we didn't draft it that way, but that's certainly the way I gave it to you yesterday, and I'm sorry about that.
All right, so hold on to the amendment. Think about all these possibilities and whether or not it is worth investing some of the money that would be made in the next couple of years that would have gone into the trust fund, if it's worth investing some of that in some of these ideas.
Madam Chair, to that
Representative
point,
Heidgerken.
We did get a handout earlier in the year. It's called the Minnesota School Trust Lands. It'd be interesting to read that so you understand how it all was created, who's overseeing it, and there's layers. Mm-hmm. As Representative Senator Erickson says, layers and layers of committees set up to oversee this, and I think we need to get their input. That's what they're getting paid for to do.
And by the way, I think this was distributed to you way back when we had kind of a little overview. And so if you have those, great. If not, Beth says she has a few of those still available.
If you're short, we have more of those.
All right. Thank you. Representative Grubbing.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'd like to second Representative Heidgerken's request because, we are the ultimate, responsible people. But on the other hand, if we have all these committees and we have not undone them, and I'm glad they're there, we have Mr. Bryce, who's a product of an agency and works for the governor and so forth. But I'd like to hear from average citizens who have studied this, weighed in on it, probably have a variety of interests, pro and con. I hope that we have appointed them that way. I don't know why we would make major decisions. This one, Representative Sikora's bill, I think is more of the same, except on a smaller scale. We're taking money from the school children because we don't haven't appropriated enough to run DNR. And I didn't oppose that one. I mean, didn't support it. I won't again. And but I would like to hear from the citizens like Representative Heidgerken does.
Madam Chair, as far as those boards go, the Executive Council is the governor, the constitutional officers. The Investment Board is the governor, attorney general, and auditor, and maybe one other. So those boards oversee things that we might recommend or manage the trust fund for you. But the advisory group is the one that would have superintendents on it.
The investment board isn't going to know anything about the real management of the lands. They invest our money and make that big 4 or 5% return we get. So I'm not sure that that's of any great value, but possibly if we can get a couple of the superintendents who were on the council in the past, so we'll have to follow up on that. But I have been trying to get that meeting going for 6 weeks, folks. It isn't that I didn't try. So if you think I can do it in the next 2 days, you've got a lot more confidence than I have.
To that point, have you contacted the Department of Finance?
On this issue?
Yeah, because they manage the PSF.
No, I haven't contacted them on this issue. But I'm sure they're aware of this. I have a hunch they know very well about this
budget.
I'm
sure that at the same time, there may be, I worry about who is pushing whose hand, and sometimes the governor may not even know what's all in play because so many things are in play. It would be nice to...
Just to help a little bit on that, Madam Chair. And that these are all initiatives that the governor's as part of the governor's budget, and we've of course worked with the finance department and the governor on these initiatives.
Mm-hmm. All right, Representative Knobloch, I want to make clear, folks. Now, the next few things that we have on the agenda, we are laying this bill over as well as the other one. See how we can handle this. But the next items that are on the agenda, House File 389, 1054, 2269 is scratched from the agenda for today. All of these, with the exception of Sailor, are all items that are in the Tax Committee that have implications for education, and I thought you ought to be at least made briefly aware of them. And so, Representative Knobloch, could we hear a little about your bill? These are all intended to be strictly informational without a lot of time given to them.
Well, thank you.
We aren't moving any bills, and we aren't amending them. We're just hearing what they are, because taxes will be dealing with them.
Sure. Well, thank you, Madam Chair and members. House File 1054 and is very similar to a couple of other bills that you may have heard about already today, a bill authored by Representative Olson, a bill authored by Representative Van Devere. And basically what it does is it makes changes to the existing education tax credit program, primarily three changes. First, it removes the family cap. Right now, we only allow the $1,000 tax credit available for up to two children in a family. And so this bill would say if you happen to have more than two children, if you have three children, you would be able to have it available for three children. I think it's sort of discriminatory for us to say that only two-child families and less are available and eligible for this tax credit. It also has some simplification that the department would very much like to see. Right now, the way the law reads, if you've got, say, two children that are both qualifying for this credit, you actually have to itemize for every single one all your expenses. So if you're talking about supplies, you've got to say, well, you know, the Spanish book for Johnny was $52, and that's in column A, and this other music lesson for Mary was $60, and it's in column B, and these pencils cost so much, and we had some pencils for Johnny, we had some pencils for Mary, and we've divided them out. We put some in column A and some in column B, and it's frankly kind of a nightmare for revenue to audit. And so we basically just say, you got $1,000 per child. You don't have to allocate between Mary and Johnny and whoever else anymore. The second thing the bill does is it makes private school tuition eligible for the credit, just like private school tuition is eligible for the deduction right now. You currently have a tax deduction in Minnesota law where if you send your child to a private school, you can deduct it on your tax return. However, you cannot claim it as a tax credit underneath this program. And actually, as a deduction, it is available for anyone, no matter how high their income is. It's rather odd in a way when you think about it. We allow a deduction for private school tuition for anyone of any income level, but this program, which is designed for lower income families, private school tuition is not available as a tax credit. Kind of strange that it's set up that way, but that's the way it's set up. So we would basically conform with the current law in terms of private school deductions and say private school tuition is eligible for the credit, just like it's eligible for the deduction. Finally, this particular bill, House File 1054, raises the income eligibility to 250% of the poverty line as opposed to the limits that exist right now, which are $33,500, phasing out up to $37,500. And frankly, we do that partly so it stays adjusted with inflation, partly to better reflect family size. I've got a number of different fiscal notes that I've had on this that reflect various variations. Frankly, I think 250% is going to be too much for what we're going to be involved in terms of the budget process here, because the fiscal note for that is in the $40 million range. But we've looked at 200%. We've looked at 185%. We've looked at adjusting the $33,500 for inflation, which would bring it up to about $40,000 from when it was originally passed 7 years ago. And so there's different ways of doing it. But in the end, the idea is we should have some adjustment for inflation, because this passed 7, 8 years ago. There's been some inflation, and there should be some adjustment. So again, to review, we eliminate the family caps. We're not discriminating with families that have more than two kids. We cover private school tuition so that we cover it for lower-income families, just like we cover it for upper-income families that have the deduction available right now. And we basically adjust the income limits to at least keep pace with inflation, or adjusted with some sort of poverty level.
By the way, I should mention that Nina Manzi is here from taxes with House Research, so that if we have some specific questions, we have an expert here to answer those questions. I'm sure she's helped probably all of the folks you'll hear from today with their bills.
And Madam Chair, I have here Liz Mishy from the Partnership with Choice in Education, and I would like to have her, and she may have another witness, to give a few words to, if there are no questions for members.
Ms. Mishy.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Is a page available? I have a little layperson's handout.
Yeah, right behind you.
Oh, I'm sorry. Thank you so much. I am the Executive Director of Partnership for Choice in Education. We're a nonprofit, nonpartisan organization that actually worked with then-Governor Arne Carlson in the development, in the inception and passage of the education tax credit and deduction. Many of you may know that since 1955, Minnesota has had a tax deduction in varying amounts for families who pay non-public school tuition, and that is available regardless of income. Currently, the law is such that every family with a child in kindergarten through the sixth grade can claim a tax deduction, that would be for middle and higher learners, of $1,625, and for children in grades 7 to 12, $2,500. So you can't earn too much money to take a tax deduction if you pay for non-public education in the state of Minnesota. Neither, of course, and neither would we want it to be possible to earn too much money to make use of a public district school in the state of Minnesota. My organization and the coalition of school choice organizations that we convene supports Representative Knobloch's proposal for a variety of reasons. We do not concur with those whose opinion it is that every single dollar that goes to a parent who invests in their child's education is a dollar, quote, diverted from public education, end quote. The majority of people who claim the current education tax credit, and keep in mind you can't earn more than $37,500 and claim a tax credit. I don't want to live on $37,500 again. I'm guessing nobody in this chamber much wants to either. But those families who earn that much money and who invest in even materials so rudimentary as pencils, art supplies, or so sophisticated as science camp, band lessons, tutoring for their children, can claim that deduction, but they can't claim the same credit when they pay non-public school tuition somewhere. Last year, the Department of Revenue estimated that 6,500 families at that level of income paid some private school tuition someplace. This year, I've seen one fiscal note that estimates 12,000 households which at that income level pay some tuition someplace. It does seem to us that this is quite counter to Minnesota's progressive history. As you know, Madam Chair, I personally am never averse to taxing other people, and I'm never averse to spending whatever money it takes to do a program well. I speak this time as myself, not for my board of directors. We feel that there's an injustice built into the current structure, which allows upper earners to take a benefit from their investment in their children, but penalizes lower-income families. One of the benefits of the tax credit is that it does what everybody with children know works. People know that where you spend your money is where your values are. And so it rewards parents who have been engaged, even at very modest levels, in working for their children. It gives them that reward. This being America, we give people cash when they've done good things. In outstate areas and in the inner city, particularly, the benefit is that this money can then be spent a second time in those communities by people of very low income. We also think that the $1,000 per child, $2,000 per family cap is, again, counter to Minnesota's progressive tradition. Families who, by principle or cultural practice, have more than two children are rather bizarrely, I must say, not given the advantage of their full investment, even though their wherewithal is quite modest. The last estimates that I had from the Department of Revenue were that 61,300 families used the ETC last year. I don't have at my fingertips the total for the education tax deduction. Again, keep in mind that the majority of those families claiming are people whose children attend public schools and will continue to be those folks. We would encourage you to vote in favor of any of Representative Knobloch's fiscal notes, no matter what the total cost. And I know that Rabbi Joshua Bornstein from Torah Academy would be glad to have a few words if there are no questions of me.
Are there any questions on this bill? All right, seeing none, Rabbi, if you wish to comment very, very quickly, you may, and then we will move on to Representative Vandeveer's version.
Thank you, Representative. Just to echo the...
Please introduce yourself for the record.
Joshua Bornstein, Executive Director of Torah Academy in St. Louis Park. Just to echo the previous statements, as an Executive Director and having close contact and knowledge with many of our families, many who are on different tuition assistance and different income levels, it is very important that we continue to invest in families that invest in their education. It's not a public versus private debate or issue, but any family that's willing to put money into their own education is something that we should be encouraging, and any family that thinks it's important enough for them is something that we should at least recognize and help them with. And certainly, where I've seen firsthand, families with larger sized families, 2, 3, 4 kids, and the income guidelines do not help follow them there, and they can't spread it out among all their children, is certainly an injustice to them. They deserve every right to get the benefits of anyone in a lower income and be able to spend what they need on education. It doesn't really help the schools. It helps the families who are already investing get the most bang for their dollar and be able to do the most for their family.
Thank you very much. Are there any questions for the rabbi? Representative Gemmer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Could you tell me what the tuition typically is at your school?
Our tuition is approximately $7,500.
Madam Chair, is that continuous? I mean, Kate, does it matter if it's kindergarten or...
Kindergarten is about $5,000. 1 through 5 is about $7,500. And then it goes up a few hundred dollars for middle school, so 7th and 8th.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you very much. Pardon? Did you wish to make a...
I just wanted to add that comparable schools, if you take out the public preparatory schools here in the city, they're quite conspicuous. Minnehaha Academy, Breck.
I think you better speak into the mic to say that, but please make it quick. We're going to move on.
Since Representative Demmer asked that question, I just want to give a context for that. Comparable schools in the Twin Cities, if one eliminates the college preparatory schools such as Blake and Breck, Minnehaha Academy, Friends School,
St. Paul Academy,
St. Thomas Academy, the average tuition for a non-pub that these people who are attending in the 14-county metro area has tuition of under $4,000 a year. Rabbi Bornstein is sort of the parentheses on one end, and a school like, for instance, Risen Christ Catholic School, which charges about $2,300, would be on the other end of that.
And, Madam Chair, I would just briefly add, too, there are many schools in greater Minnesota, Representative Knobloch here, that are less than that, who are often in the $2,000-$3,000 range. But again, while we're talking about private school tuition here in this discussion, again, this is a program I want to emphasize applies to all students, whether they are in public school, private school, or homeschool. These supplies, credits, other credits are available for students, whether they're public, private, or homeschool, and there are thousands and thousands of students right now who are in public schools who use this program.
Pardon me, Madam Chair. There is someone from the homeschool community who would like to have 2 minutes, if you have it.
All right.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I'm Pamela Von Goren. I live in Minnetonka. My family, my husband and I homeschooled our children, and I speak to you as the legislative liaison for COHERE, which is a coalition of the various statewide homeschooling associations in Minnesota. We represent a majority of the 17,000 children who are home educated in Minnesota. If the page would pass out, I have a flyer here because our organization and Ms. Michie's organization is having an educational symposium tonight and tomorrow with a former New York Teacher of the Year. But I would just like to concur with the testimony that has been given that, in general, the home education community is quite in favor of expansion of the current tax credit, particularly in the removal of the family cap and the attribution. For home educators, this is a major problem, and it is expensive to revenue, because too many of our very low-income families are subject to audit on an almost annual basis. Just this weekend, I received a flurry of calls from parents who had filed early expecting to have their income tax refund back and their credit back in time for the two major conferences this spring where they would buy their curriculum materials at a reduced rate, only to find that they are now going to be audited sometimes for the second and third year because of this attribution situation, and now they won't get their money until the end of summer. Specifically, removal of the family cap, eliminating the per-child attribution. We would certainly applaud the inclusion of tuition, which would also provide some additional resources to our families. So thank you very much for your consideration and time today.
Thank you, Ms. Van Goren. And Representative Knobloch, Representative Demmer, did you have a quick question?
You didn't.
We have no questions, so we will move on to Representative Vandeveer.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members.
Remember, this will be in the Tax Committee, so if it's something you're very interested in, you know, track it in Tax Committee for a hearing. Representative Vandeveer? House File 389, and maybe you could talk about how yours is different from Representative Knobloch's.
Madam Chair, I could if I knew. I know it's getting towards deadlines here. We might as well get to the point. Maybe Ms. Monzi could give us a brief description of the difference.
Thank you, Ms. Monzi.
Madam Chair and members of the committee, the main difference between the two bills, well, the first difference is that Representative Vandeveer's bill does not add tuition to the qualifying expenses for the K-12 education credit. The second difference is that both bills undo the family cap by allowing the credit of $1,000 per child for an unlimited number of children. Current law limits it to $2,000 per family, in effect limiting it to two children per family. The way the bills handle the phase out of the credit is different Representative Knobloch's bill sets the phase-out starting point at a percentage of the federal poverty guideline adjusted by family size, and Representative Vandeveer's bill extends the phase-out for families with more than two children. Under current law, the phase-out begins at $33,500 of taxable income, and the credit is reduced until income reaches $37,500 of taxable income, of household income. So it's a broad income measure that starts with gross income and adds in some non-taxable forms of income. So that under current law, no families with household income over $37,500 can claim the credit. Representative Vandeveer's bill would extend the maximum income eligible for the credit by an additional $2,000 for each additional child for whom the credit was claimed, so that a family claiming the credit for three children would see the phase-out begin at $33,500 and end at $39,500, and then it would extend to $41,500 for four children, $43,500 for five children, and so on. So that's the main difference between the bill and their bills and their treatment of the phase-out of the credit.
All right, Representative Vandeveer.
Yeah, the goal, Madam Chair, was just to, you know, have a bill that provided that access to educational opportunities for as many people who couldn't afford it, and to deal with the people that had more than one or two children that needed the help. And I do have a witness, Madam Chair.
Okay, members, I might mention that you have this tan piece of paper, which has a lot of information on, you know, the different ideas in the tax credit.
I do have an amendment, Madam Chair, that makes the bill, which puts the bill in the shape that I'd like it and does what staff just said it. So it does what she said it does.
All right.
And that would be the 389DE1.
And we wouldn't be taking up the amendment because we don't have really the bill before committee. This is purely informational. It's in the tax committee. So
then the members should be looking at the 389DE1.
Yes, they should. So, members, do you have any questions? And do remember that you also have this to look at. Oh. Excuse me.
You have a witness.
You have a witness.
Mr. Elwood from Legal Service Advocacy Project would like to testify.
Okay. Madam Chair, members of the committee, Ron Elwood, Legal Services Advocacy Project. We represent low-income Minnesotans, and want to thank Representative Vandeveer for bringing forward this bill. This program certainly benefits low-income folks, but one of the problems with it has always been that it really penalized, in essence, families with more than one child and even larger families. And what Representative Vandeveer's approach here is to remove that penalty, and we support that. I did want to, Representative Vandeveer and I had a discussion today, and I'd like to bring a related issue to the committee's attention, and that is the ability of low-income families to actually utilize this great program. This program requires a family to lay out money to purchase the supplies or the eligible activities, and then only later on receive the money back in the credit. And many, many families don't have the upfront cash to lay out and don't have the ability, therefore, to take advantage of the program. And so one of the things we were talking about was a possibility of having some kind of a work group get together, the Department of Revenue, Department of Education, many of the groups that have testified here today, advocacy groups like ours, other groups that represent families and children, and really take a look at this program and try to develop some creative ways that we might be able to incent or facilitate more accurately the ability of low-income families to take advantage of the program. So I just want to bring that to the committee's attention. And thank you for the opportunity to speak with you today.
All right, are there any questions? Anyone? Representative Bernardi.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just wanted to ask our testifier, there's access problems to this legislation as far as being able to use it because people of lower means can't outlay the income in advance. Are you trying to work within a framework in which we already have existing and trying to make it easier for people to access this program? Or might there be better ways to help people of lower incomes than this kind of a program?
Madam Chair, Representative Bernardi, I wouldn't suggest the limitation on creativity. So I think the answer to your question is both. I think we could potentially think of ways to utilize the existing framework better to facilitate participation, or maybe even come up with a different idea that creates a different framework to get participation. I mean, your point, I just want to support your point that, yes, access is a problem because people have to lay out money up front, and that's a problem. There was a couple of years ago, there was an addition to this bill. Former Representative Dawkins brought this forward regarding the ability to assign the credit to a third party, a philanthropic organization. And that, to some degree, has worked, but it really hasn't. It wasn't the magic bullet, and I think that this would be a good time over the interim to get the interested parties together to really think long and hard about how to make this how to better utilize the program.
Representative Vandiver. And
Representative Bernardi, I'd like to comment too. Access, I think, is a problem if you're in those income ranges because obviously you don't have a lot of money sitting around, but in trying to come up with a simpler solution, which would be just to give them the money, typically you run into all kinds of strings, and part of this is to give them choices in what those options are. And the tax credit does have that advantage in that, they are still making the decision with the money as to what they're doing with it and how they're spending it. And as Mr. Elwood told me the other day, reminded me that there has been abuse of the third-party systems in the past. And so the answer is, we're not sure we have an answer, but the access is a problem, and we should be looking at it more closely than we are. Or we have, I guess.
All right. Seeing no other questions, gentlemen, thank you very much. I think everybody's going to be trying to remember the differences between all these bills. The next two are mine. And I think 1858 is a great solution to the access problem because it's based on the idea of private people, private citizens providing donations to scholarship organizations to provide scholarships for poor children. So that's the theory behind it. And there are two pieces here. There's the individual idea and the corporate, which is the governor's proposal, which happened to be in our bill and really belonged in taxes. So I had this redone. It'll show up on today's registry and with a number. So it doesn't have a number on here. And I think we'll just quickly go through those because we have to get to the Black Duck issue, the Black Duck bill, as we call it. So Morgan Brown, would you come down, and Ms. Mishy? And Ms. Mishy, if you could just comment a little bit, I'll just say in the bill that I've got for individuals. Okay. In the bill, for individual contributions, you would get a 50% of it in a tax credit. It would have to go to people below the 75% of the statewide median income. And I will have an amendment for a couple of those things because this bill really doesn't have everything in it exactly as I wanted it. And the problem we had, it was heard 2 years ago or last year. We did have a hearing in taxes, but they had no sense of how much it would cost or how many people might contribute, so therefore it didn't pass. So I'm trying it again this year. And Liz, if you would like to, Liz Mishy is here to just make a few comments on this issue, and then we'll comment briefly on the corporate proposal as well. Please go ahead with the individual, and Mr. Brown will comment on the corporate proposal.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. Partnership for Choice in Education and the Minnesota School of Choice Coalition endorse this this bill and this concept for some of the same reasons that we would endorse the education tax credit. We feel that it engages common people in investing in decisions that people already desire to make. Children who attend non-public schools are already eligible for funding through the state student formula. And this particular kind of provision allows people like myself who are of middle income but not infinite means to make modest contributions to schools in our own vicinity. I happen to live at the top of the High Bridge in St. Paul, and I could, for instance, make an investment to become a supporter to St. Matthew's School. Or
no, it would be to a scholarship organization. You can't pick. You cannot pick the school.
Some of the schools representative would be eligible to become.
Yes, they would.
You're right. There are also incentives in here for people who are otherwise involved in children's lives, grandparents, non-custodial parents, step-parents, who would also like to make the same kind of investment. But again, I'd like to speak most particularly to this bill in the context of the national scene. I think, Madam Chair, you are to be commended for avoiding several traps that have been very problematic for similar programs elsewhere in the country. The first places that these kinds of bills came forward would have been in Florida and Arizona. Some of you will know about the Florida model or the Arizona model, and sometimes about scandals related to them. Representative Sikora's bill avoids several of these problems. For instance, it does not allow the STO, the Student Tuition Organization, or the Scholarship Granting Organization, to designate either a specific school. They'd have to serve more than one school, and it doesn't allow individuals contributing to designate for their child. For instance, in Arizona, where there were only two STOs, it became a problem because you might have made a contribution on my child's behalf, and then I'd have made one on your child's behalf, and so the contribution was not quite so foundational as it ought to have been. Also, in states where there were not already a large number of tuition organizations and where there wasn't a good infrastructure for it, it was the most conspicuous, people would found 501c3 organizations. They would give scholarships, but they would charge people $35 or $50 or $100, and they would sign up hoping that they were eligible for a scholarship, and they'd make a very tiny grant, perhaps 5 or 6. There was no requirement that they spend 80 or 85% of their revenues on kids, and so people were establishing their own little cottage industries. We also have in Minnesota an infrastructure that is better established than they are in the states that have typically tried to use these kinds of tuition organization tax credits. We have some of the most respected charitable oversight in the nation. The Attorney General does a very good job with very progressive laws for overseeing the use of charitable funds. We also have the establishment and a precedent for administration of grants of these kinds. Minnesota is kind of a tax credit state. We know how to do them. We know how to do them well. We do them efficiently. And we have a good infrastructure both of schools, a.k.a. scholarship organizations, and charitable oversight. So it's a good, solid bill. I've looked at them around the country. It's one of the cleanest and most state culture appropriate, if I can have all those hyphens, that I've seen any place in the U.S.
I think the most difficult part of this bill is trying to estimate how much how many contributions you might get and trying to figure out what the cost would be, which has been what has held us up. But thank you very much, Ms. Mishu, for your comments. And Mr. Brown, just address kind of the corporate idea that was one of the governor's initiatives.
Sure. Thank you, Madam Chair. Morgan Brown with the Minnesota Department of Education. The governor's proposal, which as you mentioned was originally in the department budget bill and now is going to be reintroduced as separate legislation, is another variation on this idea of a scholarship tax credit program. To just walk through the bill very briefly, and I'm going to start with the revenue sections, which are sections 2 and 3, and then go back to section 1. But section 3 specifies that a corporation would be allowed a credit equal to 50% of its contribution to a qualifying scholarship-granting organization that then would in turn provide financial assistance scholarship grants to low-income families to attend a K-12 private school. The maximum credit allowed for any single corporation would be $100,000. It also specifies that the credit cannot be claimed for contributions designated for a specific student, and the credit could obviously not exceed the corporation's tax liability. Section 2, which precedes that, all that does is make sure that this tax credit would be coordinated with other state tax benefits for charitable contributions, so it would preclude a corporation from getting two separate tax benefits for a single contribution to a scholarship-granting organization. If you go back to Section 1, which is most of the language in the bill, Section 1 just has the definitions for the bill. The ones I'll draw your attention to is that a qualified school in the bill, which would be a school at which a student who was receiving a scholarship grant could use a scholarship grant, was in a non-public school, not including homeschools, that comply with the state's compulsory attendance laws, that is accredited by an agency recognized by the Minnesota Non-Public Education Council, which is not operated for profit and which adheres to state and federal civil rights laws. The scholarship granting organization must be a 501c3 organization that is registered with the Attorney General's office, as Ms. Mishy mentioned, under our state charitable organization law, and would need to be certified by the Commissioner of Education. The bill then goes into subdivision 2, lists the Commissioner's duties. Again, the probably the most important one is setting up this process for certifying scholarship granting organizations and then making sure that list is widely available, and then there's some other oversight responsibilities as well. Then subdivision 3 lists the qualifications required to be a certified scholarship granting organization. Several of them are the same kind of protections that Representative Sikora has included in her bill. And then in addition, the families must, in the governor's bill, families for students that would be eligible for these grants would have to be at 200% of the federal poverty level or lower, which I believe is around $38,000 currently for a family of four, and then it's scaled to family size. Some of the other requirements in the governor's proposal would specify that only students who were not already in a non-public school when they first applied for a scholarship would be eligible for these scholarships under the tax credit program. The intent was to provide a new option that was not already being accessed by families and students that would be eligible. And it also specifies that parents of students who receive the scholarship grant would need to provide written authorization that standardized information about academic performance could be shared with the scholarship granting organization and the department. The intent of this, the governor felt it was important that for the families that would participate in this new program, there would be some way in the aggregate to study what was the impact on their academic achievement and report that in the aggregate. Certainly the individual student data would be protected, but this would be a way to do a longitudinal study to look at what was the academic impact for students who received access to this new option. And then it also lists that the scholarship grant organization would need to agree to some very basic reporting requirements on an annual basis for the department, and also give us the same annual report they're required to give the Attorney General's office under the charitable organization law. Then very finally, Subdivision 4 specifies how the application process would occur for corporations, and this relates to, as Representative Sikora mentioned, having to deal with what the cost issue is from foregone revenue under the credit. The maximum statewide tax credit is set for fiscal 2007 at $3.5 million under the statute. The way this would be handled is that corporations would come forward to the department and apply on a first-come, first-served basis until that maximum statewide tax credit was reached. They would essentially apply saying, we want to give a contribution to this scholarship-granting organization. We would make sure it was on that qualified list of scholars, that certified list of scholarship-granting organizations. We would then let the corporation know that they were approved to receive a tax credit certificate, and the corporation would be required to actually give the contribution within 60 days after receiving that notification from the department. So there would be a way to make sure that this could be done within a reasonable frame of time, and that statewide maximum tax credit would not be exceeded. So that last subdivision just specifies the process for how that would work. And I'd be happy to take any questions.
And I think once you're in a program like this for a couple of years, like Arizona and Pennsylvania, it pays for itself. It essentially pays for itself because there's some savings in what the state is putting into tuition or whatever you want to call it, whatever the state is giving to schools, because those tuitions are generally quite a bit less than our per student costs. But anyway, thank you very much. We're not going to take time for questions because we have one more bill. And it's some people from Black Duck who may have come a little distance for this. And we will run a little late, members, if you can just say I know we have a session at 3 o'clock, and we'll get you out of here well before 2:30. I will move House File 959 before the committee and recommend it be laid over for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill. Representative Saylor.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. We really appreciate the fact that we have the opportunity to present the Black Duck Vocational Learning Community proposition today. I won't say a whole lot because we're short on time and they're the folks that have all the information. But I do have to say that, you know, we've talked so much about the value of small schools this year, and they have a population of 860 K-12, so that kind of puts them right in that category. But also, I just have to share with you, I remember the first time I went to this school last spring, stopped in, and they were having music, fine arts, and industrial arts day, and I was absolutely amazed. I walked into the gym, and those of you that have gone to industrial arts days have seen an arrangement usually of stools and a few gun cases, and when I went in there, I was amazed by inlaid tables, complete kitchen cabinets, entertainment centers. I was so struck, and I thought, there's something going on in this school. We've got a wonderful teacher, instructor, who happens to be here today for questions, Bruce Anderson back there, and also a very supportive board and community. And indeed, I wasn't surprised when Senator Scoy and I were called to come and visit them earlier this year to listen to their proposal for what they would like to do for some of the vocational learning opportunities that they've identified in their school district. But again, I don't want to take your time. I would like them to be able to speak. So I will just introduce Andra Vaughn. Ms. Vaughn is the business instructor, and Merle Nord from the school board, and there's another school board member as well, Don Compton. In case you have questions later, I'll turn it over to Andra right now. We're not going to do the PowerPoint, so we'll have information passed out at the page. Thank you.
Thank you. Ms. Vaughn.
Thank you, Madam Chair, Representative. Thank you, first off, for taking the time to see us today. We know you're very busy, but in the interest of time, we are not going to show the PowerPoint. I'm going to quickly go through the fine points of the PowerPoint itself. What we are proposing today is a pilot program called the Vocational Learning Community. We have two tracks of students in our school systems today. We believe that we serve one of them very adequately, those that are going on to post-secondary education. In fact, 10% of our graduating class from last year were merit scholars. So we're very proud of the education that we provide in Black Duck. But there's another group of students, our at-risk students, that need our attention even more. These are the students that we want to serve, and through this pilot program, it would be a rigorous program, but it's, of course, relevant to them in their career track, whatever field that they would choose to go into. If you turn to page 2 of your handout, what is happening in rural education today,
Public education has been struggling for a number of years. Areas such as ours, the rural area, is hit very strongly with what additional resources that we can tap into. 31% of our ninth grade students in the year 2001 did not graduate last year. Those are significant numbers to us. We realize that we need to do something about that. That's the pilot program. Our numbers are looking about the same for this year. I'm not going to go through page 3 of the handout. That's the career outlook. As you all know, we have a very high shortage of skilled labor force today, and so I'm not going to go through that. I'm also not going to dedicate time to our mission statement, but if you will turn to page 5, which is our goals. Each goal that we have, we feel, is obtainable and measurable. We have spent a lot of time developing these goals as well as the evaluation measures by which we hope to increase our at-risk student attendance. Our first goal is improved attendance. The second one is improved graduation rate. Third one is fewer disciplinary referrals. And our first goal is to provide flexible scheduling. Not all students operate on an 8-to-3 schedule. Not all businesses operate on a 9-to-5 schedule. And so we need to provide some flexibility for our students so that they can better learn the skills that we feel are necessary for them. If you also go to page 9, the goals are also there in measurable form, and that's how we intend to evaluate each and every one of the goals. On page 6, you may ask, how do we plan to do what we want to do with this pilot program? First and foremost is curriculum redesign. We need to add programs to our existing structure in vocational English, vocational math, vocational science, and so forth. We also need to retool and redesign our facility. We need hands-on application labs. Classrooms today need to be designed to be hands-on for our students. This is the only opportunity some of our students get to become work-ready so that they can go directly into the workforce, which, if many of you are employers, you understand today that you want a student coming out of high school that can fit into any mode of operation within your business structure. You don't want to have to spend a lot of time training them because time is money. On page 2, we plan to change also through mentoring and staffing, professional development, and importantly is community and parent involvement. We want to educate our parents and the community in the redesign to ensure that we are meeting our students' needs and the needs for long-term growth. This is not a program that we want to just phase in and phase out. We want this for the duration. We strongly believe that this will increase the human capital coming out of Black Duck High School. Representative Saylor indicated, some of our school board members are here today. Our school board is behind this 100%. Our community is behind this. We have met with area businesses that think that this is a wonderful idea. They're happy that we are stepping out of the mold and doing something to educate our students in a non-traditional method. If you look at page 8, it will give you additional curriculum. Our curriculum that we would wish to expand is in two specific areas. Foundation skills, which is workplace competencies. This we took from the Department of Labor, the Secretary's Commission on Achieving Necessary Skills, the SCANS report. And some of you may be very familiar with that. It does not eliminate the fundamental skills, the reading, the writing, the mathematics, the listening, and the speaking. Those are important components to education today. We have no intention of taking those out of there. We want to add to them in a vocational manner. And then, of course, the foundation skills of resources, interpersonal, information system, and technology. Programs that will assist the programs that we already have in place, such as landscaping, building trades, computer-operated drafting, enhanced business and computer applications. If you turn to page 10, your role, or what we are asking for from you, is support to develop academic standards that are flexible for these students. The traditional classroom setting does not always work for our at-risk students. It works wonderfully for our students that are going on to post-secondary. But we need to spend more time with our at-risk students, and we need to be a little more flexible where they're concerned. And when I say flexible, I'm not saying change the standards in their entirety. What I'm saying is they may learn their algebra in their trades, such as what is the right angle of the roof that they are putting on this facility, as opposed to sitting down and drawing out a right angle. So it would be a very rigorous program that is relevant to the trade that they are doing. We are requesting from you $455,000, which I know is not small change, but it is over the course of 3 years, and that is less than 2% of our current budget. This would sunset at the end of the 2008-2009 fiscal year. This money is important to get this pilot program off the ground. We have also approached outside sources such as the Blandon Foundation. It is a foundation that has done numerous gifts in our area, and they have indicated verbally to us that they are very interested in this program as well. We understand that $455,000 over the course of 3 years will not run this program in its entirety. We understand that we from Black Duck must give, and we also understand that we must search out alternative methods of funding, which we are doing. Questions?
Representative Erickson.
Thank you, Chair Sikora. You know, I'm looking at the report card for Black Duck, and I'm looking at the grade 3 reading performance of all your students, and you do exceptionally well in grade 3 reading on the MCA achievement level. In fact, at level 4, you are far above the state, and at level 5, you are more than a percentage point above the state. Then I notice there's some decline in grade 7 in mathematics. You know, I would congratulate you on what I see, because I've looked at school districts that have scores much below yours, and so I'm a little confused about what might be happening in Black Duck to have you come here to ask for such a request.
Madam Chair, if I may respond.
Mr. Nord.
I'm glad you noticed that. I would point out that our most recent test scores recently came back. Our writing scores were in the 90s. Our reading scores are up to 88. And our math scores also increased. And that is a very relevant and very pertinent question for us. As Andra said, last year we had a graduating class of 55 students. Of those 55 students, five students were National Merit Finalists. I do not believe there is another school in the state of Minnesota that had five National Merit Finalists last year. We had two other students that had perfect 800 scores on their SAT math. What disturbs us is the graduating class of 55 students, when they were in ninth grade, was 71 students. We lost all of those students between ninth grade and 12th grade. So what we are saying, and I don't believe Black Duck is the only school that is in this dilemma. The 31% that we lost when we first started visiting with Senator Scoy and Representative Saylor was an astounding number. However, when we looked at some neighboring school districts, we found actually that number was as high as 37%. It happened to be 37% last year in Senator Scoy's district. I believe that many small schools have been forced or have chosen, either by default or because of their size, to make a choice. And in our case, we have chosen to educate our top students very, very well. And the performance of them shows that. And that's good, and I think that's what we all want to do. However, we need to continue doing that, but we need a system in small schools, two-section schools like ours, that allow us to not lose the number of students that are not the top students. We can't afford to lose those students, not only from the school's financial standpoint, but from society's standpoint, between ninth grade and 12th grade. We have to be able to direct more of our resources, more time, and we believe that we can do it with what we see as a minimal amount of retooling, restructuring our curriculum, and thereby establishing what we see as a dual-track system. Andre talked about a system that would provide for these students rigor, but at the same time provide relevance to the vocation that they are going to enter.
Representative Dorn.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And since this is proposed as a pilot that we could learn from, at some time could you provide a little more detail at what that overall cost you thought you would face would be, and then adding in the private sources, the community resources, along with what we would be putting in, and then a little bit about where the dollars would go in terms of some of the components. So just a little, maybe it's here someplace, but a higher or greater level of detail, I think, would be helpful.
Yes.
Madam Chair.
Yes, Representative. If I could address that,
Ms. Vaughn,
a little bit. We have been working on this for many months, and as you all know, it is a struggle to get all the components together. We intend to have all the dollars in place of and be accountable for exactly what we're spending these dollars on. It is an investment, and we want this program to continue. The other key to that is we have already been contacted by other schools in the area. The technical college in our area and the Bemidji State University in our area are following our progress on this intently because it's very important to them as well. And other small schools, other rural schools, are also following this to see if it is something that works and is feasible that they can implement as well.
Thank you.
Representative Clinton.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I was wondering if you guys applied for turning an application to the Department of Education for a status as a state-approved alternative program, and if you did, what happened to that, or why maybe you wouldn't do that or wouldn't want to?
Madam Chair.
Mr. Norris.
And Representative. If you are referring to an alternative learning center program, we explored the possibility of an alternative learning center. The difficulty for us to add that type of center to the school is beyond our financial means. It also, what I will say might irritate some people. We have been in many cases disappointed with the rigor that many of the alternative learning programs that we looked at, now I don't say all, but many that we looked at and that some of our students have chosen to attend, our disappointment in those programs is there. We don't feel that they are providing what we need. There are several programs in the area, most of those are 30, 35 miles away, but we still don't believe the rigor we want is there. And again, I emphasize we are looking for rigor with relevance to the vocation.
Madam Chair, quick
Representative.
Yeah, and I applaud that, and I agree with your assessment of maybe some of the area learning programs. But I believe it's slightly different. It'd be more like a program within a school. It doesn't necessarily fall under that alternative learning center program. So, but that's fine. I just wanted to check and see if you've done that.
Representative Bernardi.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and I'll be really brief, and maybe we can talk after, and I'll ask my question then. But I just want to comment. This is very fascinating to me because what I've seen a lot happening with all the mandates coming down from the federal level and the focus being on the bottom quartile rather than all students is that school districts that I see are oftentimes getting rid of their best programs that are helping their students, I shouldn't say best, but programs that are helping their high-end students, their National Scholar Finalists, and they're reducing those programs. I find it very intriguing how you're committed to those rigorous programs and how you're trying to look at how to serve the bottom quartile. And so this is really intriguing to me, and I'd like to talk to your school board about that. Thanks.
Madam Chair.
Ms. Vaughn,
Representative, if I could just comment on that. We take our lead from our area businesses.
One more question.
Our objective is to have our students employed. And in order to do so, our businesses give us feedback on almost a daily basis in some instances. And they express to us what they want. I myself was in business for over 17 years, and so I have a pretty clear understanding of what most businesses in our community are demanding as far as our graduates. And those that aren't going on to post-secondary education, those are the ones that we really want to push into getting ready to go right into the workforce.
All right, one more question, Representative Greiling.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I know it's about time to quit, and Representative Bernardi kind of got at what I was going to say. I thought, too, that it was, the No Child Left Behind and all of that is asking school districts to do exactly what you're doing. So I, like others, applaud your efforts to focus on those children.
Thank you, Representative Greiling. And this bill, House File 959, will be laid over for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill. Thank you very much. I know you have to go testify in the Senate also.
Thank you very much.
Chairman Sikora, Chairwoman there, I've got it right now. We really appreciate this. I just think it's such an exciting program when you've got a school that wants to keep, again, that top percentage of students and not give up on the others, because I know in our rural areas, all of our schools are dealing with that, situation of what do we do about that 31-37% that's just playing quit school because it's not relevant to them, and many of them are never going to be college bound, but we'd like to keep them in our communities and we'd like to keep them employed. So I think this opportunity that they're presenting us with as a pilot program is excellent, and I would certainly encourage you to consider it. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Representative Saylor. And I know the minutes are rather long. Has anybody had a chance to look at those? Representative Messina.
Madam Chair, I'll move the minutes.
Thank you. Are there any additions or corrections to the minutes? Hearing none, all those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Minutes are approved, and the meeting is adjourned.